This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Larry Klum. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Klum is in Mays, Kansas. It is approximately 7:15 p.m. Lubbock time, and it is the 29th of August, the year 2000. All right, Mr. Klum, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
All right. I was born in February of 1941 in Wellington, Kansas, which is in the southern part of the state. Grew up in the southern Sumner County, the county south of the Wichita area. Grew up on a farm. My father and grandfather and great-grandfather had all been farmers. And grew up in a little small town named Conway Springs. Played the normal sports farm kid does in a small town, football, basketball, track, and all that kind of stuff. After high school, went to college at Pittsburgh State University in Pittsburgh, Kansas. I graduated in 1964 with a degree in business administration. I worked for a company in Kansas City for a couple of years. And then in late 65, why the draft notices started getting coming hot and heavy, and Lyndon Johnson kind of said, y'all come, and I did not want to particularly join the Army, so I talked to the Air Force and was joined the Air Force in February of 1966. Went to basic training in Lubbock, Texas.
Okay. Now, what made you decide on the Air Force?
I think mainly because the Air Force, it just fit me a little better. I thought it was intellectually a little bit easier, a little bit more laid back. I'd taken ROTC in college, so I knew the military side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And but I thought as far as what it offered me and just the fit between myself and what I could get done in the Air Force made me choose it.
Okay. And what did your folks think about you joining up?
Oh, they were, well, you know, everybody, not everybody, but a lot of young guys were having to go at that time. And my dad had not been in the service. He was prime age during World War II, but he was 4F. And his dad was prime in World War One, and was farm exempted.
Mm-hmm.
And so neither one of them had been in service. But my dad was, he thought it was all right that I went. My mother, of course, and mothers are always a little bit hesitant. And but they were happy. They were proud to see me go.
Mm-hmm. And your father, what did your family think about you going in during Vietnam, both your mother and your father?
I really can't remember any reaction. I don't think they had an opinion
mm-hmm.
on Vietnam at that time. This was 66, and it was still pretty patriotic thing at that point.
Mm-hmm.
This was a couple years away from the protests.
Okay. What did you think was going on in Southeast Asia?
I knew I'd already had a friend killed over there.
Did you?
A young gentleman named Ralph Redmond, who was I went to college with at Pittsburgh, who was an ROTC. He was an Army. Played basketball with him in college. He was a very tall, he was about 6'6", black kid. One of the real nice guy, and he went over there in one of the first advisory groups.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was over there in 60. I think he was killed. I've seen his name on the wall, and I can't remember exactly when he was killed. It seemed to me like 64.
Mm-hmm.
He'd only been in country about 10 days.
Okay.
And then several of my other friends had gone directly out of college into the military, mm-hmm. ROTC commissions, and so about probably half a dozen of my fraternity brothers. And we had kind of kept in touch, and they were all Army,
mm-hmm.
and some of them were already on their way over there. So I was aware of what was going on.
Okay. What did you think the United States was trying to accomplish?
at that time,
mm-hmm.
What the U.S. was trying to accomplish.
Yeah, in Southeast Asia, in Vietnam in particular.
Yeah, the I guess it, at that point you were hearing the Eisenhower domino theory,
mm-hmm.
Saving Southeast Asia from falling into communism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there had been Vietnam, then Thailand, then Malaysia, you know, then eventually Australia.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the theories that you heard.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm if I remember my thinking back at that time, that's probably what I was thinking also.
So you agreed with that as a philosopher?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. And what about your fellow classmates, just as you were getting out of high school?
Out of high school? Well, high school wasn't going on. High school, I got out of there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
59.
59.
So there was,
okay.
Out of college.
Out of college, right.
There, I remember some discussions in the fraternity house, in the dormitories,
mm-hmm.
about there's some guys at that point were questioning, what are we doing over there?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they aren't attacking us, this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority of the opinion was, you know, hey, we're going to go over there to help these people.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of agreement with the
yeah.
policy even in college before
yeah.
you left.
Yeah, I had, there was no there were no, you know, overt protests or
mm-hmm.
or anything like that.
Okay.
At that point.
Mm-hmm. When you joined the Air Force, did you have a particular MOS in mind that you were going to try to get, or?
No, I didn't. I was wanting to stay. You know, I did good. Did well on all the basics.
Mm-hmm.
The MOS I wanted in the Air Force they call it AFSC,
mm-hmm.
an Army's MOS. But I was looking at language.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted. I'd heard of the Monterey Language School, which they, you know, send everybody for particular, well, for all the languages,
mm-hmm.
and do a language immersion type. You speak it from the day you walk in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I was looking at, and I was kind of didn't really know where I was going to be,
mm-hmm.
or where I was going to be stationed, if I'd be going to Europe or stay in the States or go to Southeast Asia. So I was kind of looking at possibly taking Russian or Chinese,
okay.
at the language school, and this is what I remember. This is what I put in for.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get it, but that's what I that was my main interest at that time.
So when did you actually enter basic training?
May of 1960, late April of 1966.
Here in Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah, in Lackland.
Lackland Air Force
yeah.
Base. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and describe that training?
At that time, the Air Force was gearing up. In fact, you know, they were pulling guys in as fast as they'd get them. This was Johnson's big buildup.
Mm-hmm.
I think they needed half a million people trained in a specific period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so basic training had been shortened from 8 weeks to six. And then when I got there, basic training was only 4 weeks.
Wow.
They crammed us in there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't, it was 4 quick weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And really was fairly easy.
Okay.
I went in at about 205 pounds and came out at 215.
Wow.
So because the chow was good. Because
okay.
all you did was march and eat, it seemed like.
Okay. Not a real challenge.
Huh?
No,
it wasn't a challenge at all. And I was almost 26 years old when I went in.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else was about 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd been through ROTC and the TIs. I was older than some of the TIs.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'd seen the drill before, and I had to pretty much kind of bite my lip a lot of days. Keep from busting out laughing,
mm-hmm.
because of the, you know, and they were just scaring the bejesus out of some of these 17-year-olds, and,
yeah.
You know, because a lot of these kids had never been anywhere in their life.
Mm-hmm.
There was one black kid from Selma, Alabama, and if you remember back during that time,
oh, yeah.
Selma, Alabama was a hotbed of black protest,
yeah.
and Martin Luther King and the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
And I never heard, he was in a room right across from me, and I never heard him say anything for the first 2 weeks, never uttered a word. And any time off, he was on his bunk, mm-hmm. laying there staring at the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in one day, and I can't remember what his name was, and I said, I introduced myself, and I said, he says, oh, yeah, I know who you are and what your name is. And I said, he's kind of quiet. And he said, I'm afraid. And I said, why? And he said, I'm afraid only white boys is going to kill me.
Wow.
And I said, well, what, that really, you know, it shocked me.
Yeah.
And I said, what are you talking about? And then he told me where he was from, Selma, Alabama, and he'd never been more than a mile and a half from his house in his entire life.
Oh, wow.
So this was a cultural shock for him,
mm-hmm.
getting thrown into, you know, Air Force Base with about 99.9% of the flight being white.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was one other black kid and a couple of Mexicans in our flight. Everybody else was from, you know, Minnesota and Michigan and Missouri,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, Kansas. And so that was I never forgot that, because, you know, once I, you know, I told him, hey, nobody's going to kill you, then he was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But he spent the first 2 weeks terrified.
Wow.
That somebody was going to kill him in his sleep.
Oh. Now, had he gotten any warnings from, say, family members or anything like that?
To him?
Yeah, that he should be careful?
No.
About white people or anything
Oh,
like that?
You know, I don't know. I suppose mm-hmm. he may have. I'm sure he had to get it from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but just maybe the area that, you know, El Selma, Alabama. You
yeah.
know, that's, that was an area that was probably, you know, it was not, wasn't too great to be a black
mm-hmm.
kid at that time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Any other interesting events that occurred during your basic?
Yeah, probably the funniest thing that happened was in the service during basic training. And it's part of the training and part of the to teach you the military way.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you know, if you screw up, they give you what they call a gig slip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if your shoes aren't polished or your belt buckle's crooked, or, you know, they give you the inspections.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they inspect your rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And they inspect your lockers, all your hanging clothes. The hangers are supposed to be 1 inch apart, and all the buttons buttoned, and all the, you know, all the socks folded a certain way, and the mm-hmm. T-shirts a certain way, towels a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the discipline side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd go, you know, I always got a pink slip or a gig or two in the first couple of inspections. I was the dorm. The TIs made me the dorm chief since I'd had ROTC and knew how to drill and march them and all that kind of stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
And I was kind of a gopher for the TI too out on the when we were out on the drill field. And the TI had forgotten something one day, and the assistant wasn't there. So he hollered. He said, "Go back in the barracks and get my clipboard." Gave me the key to the day room. He said, "Bring me back my clipboard." So,
mm-hmm.
I went in. The barracks was locked. Supposed to, it was locked when I unlocked it. Went in to the day room and got his clipboard, and I heard a noise down the hall. Well, I knew there wasn't supposed to be anybody in the building. Everybody was supposed to be out in the, either at sick bay or out in the drill field. So I walked real quietly down the hall, and this one of the doors was open to one of the rooms, and I looked in. Well, there was the assistant TI. And he had a clipboard. And in his other hand, he had a plastic bag. And in that plastic bag, there was laundry tags and cigarette butts and dirt and lint, this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he would unbutton a button on a shirt in the locker and then put a cigarette butt or a piece of lint or something and then button it back up.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would write down on his clipboard where that was. And I saw him sit there and do it, and he was writing and doing stuff in there, and I walked in, and I said, "Sergeant, what are you doing?" And he turned around and looked at me, and and he knew I was older, and he said, "You're not going to say anything." And I said, "No, I'm not going to say anything." And I said, but I said, "You will bring me free cigarettes." To the end of basic training. And he said, "Done deal."
Wow.
So I didn't say anything, but I also never got any, me or my roommate never got a gig slip the rest of the time either.
Uh-huh.
So, that was the other part of the deal. No gig slips and free cigarettes.
Did you ever feel guilty for that deal?
Huh?
Did you ever feel guilty for that deal?
Oh, hell no. Because that's part of the deal, you know, that's just part of being there, but you know, you make do with what you have, but that's what they did. He said, we got to talking about it, and he said, we all do that. He said, what would be the fun if you make your room perfect, and then we walk in, and everything is perfect, and we haven't got anything to chew anybody else out about.
Yeah.
So you got to, you know, you have to make something, to get the point across about discipline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people go nuts because they know that they buttoned those buttons. They know they had an inch
between,
and then all of a sudden they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because inspection was always after drill.
Mm-hmm.
So this gave him time for an hour or two to go back there and make all these screw ups and write them all down.
Unreal.
But I always wondered how they always knew exactly which shirt or which pair of pants or which drawer to go to that was screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as I saw him, well, then all of a sudden everything became very clear.
Okay. And, well, you know, was this training in any way effective for you, the basic training that you received?
It was so hurried that it was, because I was assuming at that time that I'd have some, you know, some advanced training in a tech school. At that time, so it was. I figured it was just more like it was more PT than PT than anything, because I'd already had a lot of the, you know, the ROTC training and 2.5 years ROTC. So I, you know, the drilling part was pretty much an automatic for me.
Mm-hmm. And when did you find out what your actual specialty would be?
I think the last week the orders came out what we were going, and I got a. The tech school was full. Like I say, they were running people through as fast as they could.
Mm-hmm.
My tech school, and I was my FSC was Air Intelligence.
Okay.
And the tech school at that time was at Lowry Air Force Base in Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And but the tech school was full. There was a 10-week waiting period to get into tech school.
Wow.
Well, if there was a couple of 3 weeks, then they would have put you in what they call casual barracks, you know, and you just swept up cigarette butts for 2 weeks until they got, you know, had an opening so you could get there.
Mm-hmm.
But 8 to 10 weeks, they said no, so they gave me a what they call a direct duty assignment.
Okay.
And so I went in OJT type situation.
Okay. And what? Where was this?
At Beale Air Force Base in Marysville, Yuba City, California, in SAC.
Okay.
I went into a SAC intelligence vault and worked with, you know, took care of the maps and the target folders.
Mm-hmm. And what was the name of the specialty that you had? It was just intelligence?
Or? Air intelligence.
Air
intelligence. Yeah.
Okay.
And there's the AFSC number is 204 XO, and this is start off with, and then you're really reach various levels of education, and then it goes to 204.30, 204.5, and 204.7.
Okay.
And I think 204.9 is the top of it. But you're up into a career guy, you know, master sergeant and above before you get into that area.
Okay. Did you like this work?
Oh yeah. It couldn't have been better. As far as, I mean, it was, my whole 4.5 year tour was, I couldn't have scripted it any better.
Mm.
If you're going to be in the military, to do what I got to do was, I couldn't have planned it all on my own any better.
Mm.
But I enjoyed the intelligence worker, and you know, even in SAC, and SAC is a pretty boring branch of the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, you know, you're sitting there waiting to, you know, go bomb the bejesus out of China or Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if everything is make do and make ready and practice and practice and redo and re-practice, and so you get until you do everything in your sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of boring, and I was glad to get out of that.
Now, FAC in the combat context is forward air controller. This isn't the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Oh, no. No, in fact, of course, you're dealing with the bombers and the, you know, the B-52s, and that mission was to, of course, to bomb Russia and China. When mm-hmm. I was in there for about 9 months, because I volunteered for Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
About 60 days, I guess, after I got on the base.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got my orders about another 6 months after that, so I wasn't there quite a year. And then I volunteered for Vietnam and got sent to Thailand.
Okay.
At that point.
What led you to volunteer for Vietnam?
Just wanted to go. I figured if I was going to be in the military, there wasn't any reason to stay in the States. Might as well be where the action is.
Okay.
Just simple as that.
What did your family think of this?
They were concerned, you know, and I didn't know what was going to happen. Of course, neither did they.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were concerned at that point. And I told them, you know, they don't give you when your orders come out, they give you a post office box,
mm-hmm.
what they call an APO number,
mm-hmm.
and of course you don't know where that is. You know, it could be any place in Vietnam or Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a couple of weeks to find out, you know, that it was actually Thailand that I was going to,
because
mm-hmm. it gave you the name of the base and then an APO number. Well, hell, I'd never been there. I didn't know where these bases were and what the names of any bases were in Vietnam at all.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Saigon, and that was about it.
Okay. And did you know what you'd be doing when you went overseas? You didn't know what your job would title would be?
No, I didn't know. Well, I knew. The orders stated I would be with the 8th TAC Fighter Wing and be working in the wing Tactical Command Center.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was going to be actually doing, my day-to-day duties, didn't know that until I got there.
Okay. And what month and year was this that you found out you'd be going to Southeast Asia?
I got my orders, I think, in November of 66,
mm-hmm.
and I left for Thailand in, I think, the 20th of March in 67.
Okay. So Vietnam is in full swing. There's a lot of, the beginnings of some debate, public debate about what's going on
in Vietnam. Yeah, it was starting. I never paid any attention to it, there was a little bit. Of course, I wasn't around college campuses anymore. So,
mm-hmm.
And of course, when you're actually in the military, when you're actually in uniform, and you're on a base, you're a little bit isolated unless something's on TV every night,
mm-hmm.
you know. But as far as interaction with civilians. And unless you just happen to run into a covey of them,
mm-hmm.
of war protesters or people that had a different opinion,
mm-hmm.
You really didn't think about it that much.
Okay.
And at that point, there in Northern California, you wasn't. Now you go down to, I used to go down to San Francisco quite a bit on leave, or on weekends. But we never wore uniforms, so. We weren't like the Navy guys. The Navy guys had to wear uniforms when they were in town on weekends, which
mm-hmm.
they were made them good targets for what was starting to be the protest movement in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and also made them prime bait for the hookers too.
Okay, which was that good or bad?
Well, it was fun to me because uh-huh. I enjoyed just talking to them in the doorways. And that area of San Francisco is gone now, and it's a shame because
mm-hmm.
It was a fantastic. It was so different.
Mm-hmm.
They had these ancient old buildings; they were all in real good shape. But we'd walk from one of the old hotels down in the Tenderloin District and catch a cable car down to what they called North Beach at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in the heyday in the first year or so of the topless craze.
Oh, okay.
The topless bars in that North Beach area was full of them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, naturally, you know, young GI, that's where you go.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go to San Francisco Art Museum, you go down to North Beach.
Right.
And, but walking from the hotel to the cable cars was, that was probably as much fun as anything, because every doorway had a pair of hookers.
Okay.
And there's usually either one black and one white, or a Chinese and a white, or a Chinese and a black. They were never two of the same race.
Mm.
And it was just fun talking to them, because they we weren't gonna, you know, they we just weren't gonna participate.
Mm-hmm.
But we had it took us half an hour to 45 minutes to go a block or two, just standing there shooting the breeze with these,
mm-hmm.
with these hookers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you knew what they were there for.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what they were there for.
Right.
And some of them were some of them had great personalities.
Uh-huh.
They really did.
What was the average age, do you recall?
Pardon?
Do you recall the average age?
Oh, of the hookers?
Yeah.
Oh, golly, it's hard to tell. Some of them are pretty hard, but I would say 25.
Okay.
I'm sure after 25 in that profession, they probably start going downhill pretty quick.
Yeah. Okay. And let's see. Anything else you want to talk about before going over to Southeast Asia with regard to your stateside tours?
No.
You didn't receive any other training before you left for Thailand?
The training, you know, of course, we had training in the assignment ourselves, a lot of book work. And since I hadn't gone to tech school,
mm-hmm.
all I had to do a lot of it on my own and then take the tests. And those were administered usually by one of the top sergeants.
Mm-hmm.
In the outfit, and so we'd had to take tests every couple of weeks. We'd go through part of the book and part of the training that I would have gone through had I gone through the tech school in Colorado.
Okay. And did you find that to be effective training?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very effective.
Did that eventually help you when you got to Southeast Asia?
Yeah, it did.
Okay. Can you be more specific as to how? Or
Well, it got me prepared. There was a lot of map reading, a lot of photo interpretation, because
mm-hmm.
I did quite a bit of that while I was over there too, mm-hmm. doing PI work, either on bombing, the photo, what they call recce photos or reconnaissance photographs that take
mm-hmm.
after something was bombed, whatever the target, and then the film would come back into us and we'd interpret it. Check for damage, check old photographs of the same spot and compare them, you know, to see if the guys hit anything or if they hit the carrot and pea patches.
Okay.
But
so,
that was, it was an effective training and got me prepared. It gave me a heads up on what I was going to be doing over there.
Okay. And when did you actually depart the United States for?
I think about the 20th, 21st of March, 67. And we left first stop, that was from Travis Air Force Base, California, which is that was a jump-off point and also the point where everybody returned from Southeast Asia.
Okay.
And I left there and went, we stopped for a few hours in Hawaii, in Honolulu, and I got my old high school football coach who lived there, and I got to talk to him on the phone in about an hour,
mm-hmm.
and he was a Hawaiian guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd gone back over there to teach and be with his family. And I think there from there to Guam to the Philippines, Clark Air Base in the Philippines to Saigon, and then from Saigon to Bangkok. And then in Bangkok is where we spent either one or two nights there in a, they had an Air Force hotel there that was one of the local hotels that the Air Force, or the military, I guess the military period, basically paid for all the rooms.
Mm-hmm.
Nice hotel.
What were your first impressions when you got off the planes in Southeast Asia?
Heat and the smell, the humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been to Florida in high school. Down in Miami just for a short period of time. And, of course, it smelled tropical.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the first thing that hit you was because in March you were just in just starting into the hot season,
mm-hmm.
just before the rainy season. It was still kind of dry,
mm-hmm.
but still, you know, it was 95 degrees and 90% humidity,
mm-hmm.
and so you instantly start to sweat.
Yeah.
And I knew it was going to be interesting.
Can you elaborate on that comment?
Well, I was anxious to get on with it.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been somebody that's always wanted to know what's on the other side of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I had friends over there, guys I worked with, in both tours, both times I was over there, that never left the base.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't think there was anything interesting off base, so why should they go?
Okay.
And I never understood that thinking.
Because
the first thing I wanted to do was, get down there with the locals and talk to them, learn the language, and see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
The first night there, I jumped in a taxi. I didn't know, yes from no, and the language, and I just hopped a taxi. And they'd take me to a bar.
Mm-hmm.
So he took me to several that night. Got some of the local culture.
Mm-hmm. Did you receive any kind of briefings or anything as far as conduct?
At Travis, before we left, they gave a general briefing, and of course it was mainly aimed at the guys that were going to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
I didn't ask, but I remember somebody that was going to Thailand asking them about Thailand, mm-hmm. what were the rules there, was there danger on the streets, was, mm-hmm. What to look for, this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a clue,
mm-hmm.
so it wasn't even, they didn't know what was going on in Thailand.
Okay.
And so there was no briefing there.
Hmm. Did you find that to be odd?
No. Figured I'd find out when I got there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if there was any fighting going on in Thailand. Mm-hmm. You never know what's on the news.
Right.
Bangkok, I read, read history and studied a little bit of history in college, and of course geography, so I knew where it was, and I knew what the people did, and I knew that the king of Thailand offered Abraham Lincoln 100 elephants to fight the Civil War with,
mm-hmm.
and that was about it.
Okay. What were your first impressions of the people that you met?
Great. The Thai people were I fell in love with them from the first time I got off the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and still have a huge respect for them.
Mm-hmm. What was it that you liked about the Thai people, the Thai culture?
Well, it's called the Land of Smiles.
Okay.
And Thailand was never conquered by anybody. They were never a colony of France or England or U.S.
Mm-hmm.
They were, of course, taken over by the Japanese during World War II. But that was kind of a benevolent thing, because the Japanese didn't know what the hell to do with them either.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Thais have a way of absorbing you into their culture,
okay.
and not taking your culture,
mm-hmm.
and going by it. You end up being more like them,
mm-hmm.
and they end up being like you.
Okay.
And they bend, but they don't break. In other
mm-hmm.
words, they're a very peaceful people, and I guess that's the Buddhist 99% of the country is Buddhist,
mm-hmm.
and they just are a nonviolent people.
Mm-hmm.
They'll fight you at the drop of a hat if you press them, but
mm-hmm.
they just aren't they are not aggressive. They don't have an aggressive nature
okay.
about them.
Okay.
And I just enjoyed him from the start. Of course, you're the GI. You know what they're there for. They're there to take your money out of your pocket.
Okay.
But you learn that, and pretty soon you learn where to go and where not to go. And it's more fun to take off on the side streets and talk to people that have never seen an American before than it is hang out on. On Sukhumvit Road or Phetchaburi Road or one of the places where all the joints were.
Mm-hmm. So you found yourself...
Huh?
You didn't find yourself sticking to the, I guess, what would be the typical haunts.
Oh, I went to them,
mm-hmm.
sure. But I would much rather go in to buy a quart of whiskey at the MCO Club which cost about $4, and give it to a taxi driver, and he could sell it on the black market for $50.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, he was my limo driver for the weekend.
Okay.
And he'd take you wherever you wanted to go. And I'd always ask them, after I learned the language, to, I want to go where a Thai goes, a restaurant, or a nightclub.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd always kind of look at me funny because, you know, they always think you want to go, you know, go down to the strip joints and places where, and sometimes it took me a while to figure it out. And once they figured it out, they thought that was pretty neat. So they'd take me to some, and usually I had somebody with me that wanted to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hit some of the places that Americans don't ever see at that time. And those were a lot of fun, and they were enjoyable. Learned a lot about the country and the people that way.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about rules about interacting with the civilian population? There weren't any as far as restrictions, you know, no frequenting, you know, prostitutes,
oh, they had,
that kind of stuff?
They had off-limits places, the bars around the bases. The air police would come around every once in a while, and if there was, if there had been, let's say there had been more than one or two fights in a particular bar, that the air police had to either go break up or go take somebody back to base. I think they had a limit. If there was two fights or something, well, then they'd put a big sign on the side of the building, you know, off limits to military personnel.
Okay.
And that usually lasted for a couple, 3 weeks, and they'd come back and take the sign off. But in Thailand, there were not a lot of rules. Or all the girls, of course, prostitution was completely legal in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And all the girls had what they called VD cards. They were supposed to go to the doctor once a week, once a month, whatever it is, and get checked for venereal disease. Well, Thailand is also is a country of they'll bet on anything, and if you want anything done, you pay money.
Okay.
So the bribes were there, and so the VD cards really didn't mean anything, because all they do is give the cop or give the bureaucrat that was stamping the VD cards, you know, give them $5, and then you got a new VD card. Never saw the doctor.
Okay.
So you did have to watch that.
Mm-hmm. And let's see. Did you ever run into any problems when you were?
Never. I walked the streets. I walked the streets sometimes not in too good a shape, physically, and had a little too much to drink. Never was accosted by anybody ever.
Mm.
And I only knew, I think in the time I was there a total of about 30 months, two tours. I know one kid that was had a knife pulled on him. One kid got shot through his hand with a kid with a robber with a .38,
mm-hmm.
and of course that robber with the .38 was caught and executed the next day.
Wow!
Yeah, you don't have too many guns in Thailand because the penalty for armed robbery with a pistol is it's execution.
Wow!
So it's they don't have a lot of problem over there with armed robbery because.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just go up and rob something, you know, they'll put you in jail for a few months. But you don't want to do it with a gun.
Okay.
That's why burglaries are over there. The second story men are so good.
Mm.
Is because, you know, they steal stuff out of your house at night while you're in the day while you're not there.
Mm-hmm.
They don't confront you.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy got shot because he just happened to come home at the wrong time.
Oh.
And there was some guys in his bungalow and.
Mm-hmm.
One thing led to another, but there were confrontations between civilians and the GIs around the bars sometimes, but that was normally brought on by the GIs. It was never any aggression by the Thais. GIs get drunk, but the Thai police usually handle the situation pretty well. They just kind of walk in there and just kick the dog crap out of the GI.
Okay.
And which was, that was perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
The air police said that, do that. And they didn't take any crap. Those little Thai cops were, 5'3" and about 110 pounds, but they could jump up in the air and kick a 6'6" GI in the face about four times before he hit the ground.
Wow.
So, you know, they knew their martial arts very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it was, and everybody figured that out pretty quick, so mm-hmm. there usually wasn't much of a confrontation between the police and the GIs. And but a couple, you know, after a couple nights in Bangkok on the first tour, then of course then you hop the C-130 taxi plane that takes you up to the, you know, to the base that you were at, which mine was about 200 miles northeast of Bangkok, was where the base was.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and talk about that. What was your primary mission, your primary duty,
okay.
at your base camp, and what? What was the name of the base camp?
It was Ubon, U-B-O-N, Ubon Royal Thai Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in Ubon, Thailand. And it's east central, actually more toward the Laotian border in the eastern part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And more north-northeast or east-northeast. And kind of sits out there by itself, about 75 miles from the Laotian border, the Mekong River.
Mm-hmm.
And the 8th TAC fighter wing was there, which turned out to be the biggest MiG killing wing in the war. And the big sign over the headquarters was Strategic Air Command. Their motto was "Peace is our profession."
Mm-hmm.
You know, which meant that, you know, they were there to deter war
mm-hmm.
and to keep the peace. With
mm-hmm.
Well, the motto over our headquarters was "Peace is not our profession."
Okay.
And when I got there, I couldn't have gotten there at a better time because we had a gentleman who was the wing commander who was a full rebel himself. His name was Colonel Robin Olds.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've got anything in your files about him yet.
The name is familiar.
If you don't, you will. There is a new book. This is an aside you might write down. It's called Fast Movers.
Okay.
Stories of Southeast Asia, jet fighter pilots. The guy's name is Sherwood, I believe. Brand
okay.
new book out.
Mm-hmm.
And it is fantastic. It's got a whole chapter on Robin Olds and his life.
Mm.
The guy was amazing. Pilots that I knew to a man
mm-hmm.
said they'd follow him into hell. And the only reason they would is because they knew he'd be the only one to bring them back out of it.
Wow.
And he made a wing that was really in bad shape. There was a Colonel Wilson who was the wing commander before he got there, and they had lost a lot of airplanes to the North Vietnamese. And this was just the start of what they call the Rolling Thunder, which was the overall mission to bomb the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And they had lost a lot of aircraft. Tactics were poor, and the Pentagon said, "Hey, we gotta do something here." And they reluctantly put Robin Olds in there because he was the kind of a guy who had zero respect for authority. Anybody who did not fly an airplane or fight and bleed, and I'm talking officer. He had no patience with staff officers who had never fought, and he pissed off a lot of people over the years.
Mm-hmm.
He was full colonel from 1951 to 1970. So that tells you how long he had before he got a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was the wing commander. The day he got there, he changed the whole thing. And I got there about 4 months after he had been there, and mm-hmm. things were really starting to turn around. And it was the esprit de corps and the mission of the base was, the attitude. It was just absolutely electric when I got there, and I didn't know who Robin Olds was, anything about it, but mm-hmm. I soon found out.
So what was the primary mission of the base?
Primary mission of the base was what they call Operation Rolling Thunder, which
mm-hmm.
was to bomb Hanoi and mm-hmm. shoot down MiGs, mm-hmm. and to try to bring the North Vietnamese to the peace table. I guess mm-hmm. was the primary mission here, mm-hmm. and knock down bridges, electric plants, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, all of the bases in Thailand were all coordinated. You had Ubon, Udorn, Tak Li, Korat, Nakhon Phanom, which was more of a special operations base. But the other four were all targeted, were all geared toward Vietnam, and they were either flying F-105s or F-4s.
Okay.
And at Ubon, it was the F-4s, and their mission was mainly what they call MIGCAP, Combat Air Patrol, to protect the F-105s from the other bases from the North Vietnamese MIGs.
Okay.
And Oles was a ace from World War II, shot down 12 or 13 Messerschmitts, and he was just a warrior,
mm-hmm.
and they called him Old Lionheart, and it was a good name.
Mm-hmm.
And it fit.
Okay.
But if you get a chance, that's the man you need to interview.
Okay.
Sometime, if you ever get the chance, because he was unique. There are not many warriors left, and he's one of them.
Mm. Now, does he participate in the TLCB's organization?
He was our guest speaker in July when we had our third reunion.
Mm-hmm.
Gave a fantastic speech, and just like in the old days, he's 78 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But he outlasted us all that night
until
4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow!
And nothing but one battle story after another.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that missed that missed a unique opportunity. And he's writing a book. He's writing an autobiography.
Okay.
But he's doing it by himself on a typewriter.
Wow!
And so they're trying this. A couple of guys who are writers, they have a writers' school, writers' conference type thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get him into the writers' conference so they can speed this process up.
Mm-hmm.
And because I don't know how many pages he could write, but it'd be a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
But my job there was target intelligence,
mm-hmm.
which meant that my primary job was to build the target folders from what we call the FRAG,
mm-hmm.
FRAG, which was the daily order of battle. Told the wing where they were going, what the targets were, what time they leave, what time they get back,
mm-hmm.
And that then you work from that order of battle every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would break out the frag, determine the targets, and then a couple of us would we'd make up the mission packets, which would be an expanded folder,
mm-hmm.
one of the old brown ones, with expansion on the side. And in that, we would put maps to get there, maps of the target, photos of the targets, as recent as we could find, and any other information that the pilot needed to get there and get back.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would come in and pick those up from us, go to a briefing room, and then they were briefed on the mission, briefed on weather, briefed on the anti-aircraft that was in the area, briefed on if they would maybe encounter any MiGs, if the MiGs might come up that day, which the North Vietnamese didn't fly unless they absolutely had to,
because mm-hmm.
they knew that they were toast if they came up and fought us
mm-hmm.
Fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were hit-and-run type. They'd jump up and hit and then go back and land. And because of the wonderful rules of engagement that our wonderful civilian directors in Washington gave us, you could not shoot a MiG when it was on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
It was King's X when they were down there,
mm-hmm.
Which was not a lot of fun to have to work around, but
no.
You did it.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd brief them on the AAA, the surface-to-air missiles, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would go jump in their airplanes and take off and do it.
Okay.
and then we'd sit around and wait for them to come back.
Now, could you describe in a little bit more detail what you would do in terms of your role in preparing these missions?
You mean as far as, preparing the maps or?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the targeting. I mean, my understanding of targeting in Vietnam is, of course, as I'm sure you're better versed in this than I could ever be.
Okay.
Is that there was a lot of targeting information or targeting instruction that was coming from a very high level.
Oh yeah. We had what we call JCS targets,
mm-hmm.
Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
That was a group of targets that the Pentagon handed out, and many of those were picked by Lyndon Johnson himself.
Right.
And Robert McNamara.
Yeah.
Two guys who knew boo crapola about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was there were targets, and you hit those targets. And those targets were hit again and again and again, so there wasn't anything left of them after a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But still, they would be pulled up. You still get them as a target.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just... when you're directing it from 10,000 miles away, you don't know what's happened day to day.
Right.
And I've talked to a lot of guys that were in Honolulu, which was a big photo interpretation center. Well, they got a lot of the photographs from the daily photographs of the battle and of the damage.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all. A lot of them said that a lot of stuff that they put out, they couldn't even send back to us because Washington said it wasn't necessary to give us all that information.
Oh, for crying out
loud. Yeah, we were hamstrung a lot. It
mm-hmm.
was not a lot of fun sometimes over there to actually conduct the war.
Mm-hmm. But
a lot of times we snuck around it, and we did a few things that. Could have got us into trouble, but we also got some damn good results out of it.
Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the one that I was involved in that, in fact, let me tell a story, and then I'll tell you something that happened about a year or so ago that I got an email from a guy
mm-hmm.
that also remembered it. The rules of engagement were sent down by D.C.
Mm-hmm.
and by the Pentagon, where you could fly, where you couldn't fly,
mm-hmm.
what you could bomb, what you couldn't bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in South Vietnam, it was, most of it was around the bases where they had called no-fire zones.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that's where the Viet Cong would set up, was in no-fire zone, because they knew that you couldn't fire into that area.
Mm-hmm.
Without special permission.
Yeah.
So naturally that's where they set up their mortars, and that's where they fired from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we weren't involved in that because we didn't have anybody shooting at us from outside the perimeter of the bases.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a building up in the Plain of Jars in Laos
mm-hmm.
that was called the Chinese Cultural Center. And it was a big building with a red tile roof. It had the curly corners on it, like the Chinese, or typical Chinese roof.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a building that was built by the Chinese to house cultural mementos, and it was kind of a gift to the Laotian people. And this building was no bomb. I mean, you couldn't bomb it.
Hmm.
There was a big circle around it on every map. No bomb.
Wow.
Well, we knew it was from intelligence that we'd gathered. We knew it was full of ammunition. A place that was full of ammunition and bombs and food and anything for North Vietnamese troops. And we said we got to get rid of this goddamn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was one pilot and one backseater. And we kind of sat around joking about it one day, and because he'd come up and ask me, he said, "What the hell is this?" And I said, "That's the Chinese Cultural Center." So I pulled a picture of it,
mm-hmm.
and I told him the history of the place and that it was full of ammunition. And so he was kind of a rebel type guy, and he said, can we bomb it? And I said, no, not officially. And he said, what about unofficially? And I said, well, sure, I suppose we could figure something out. So we got out the maps, and you had to find an opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't just target the area.
Right.
This had to be sometime when he was going on a particular mission and maybe come back, have a few bombs left, and have what they called an armed reconnaissance mission where they could go looking for trucks or looking for some targets of opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we made up a little phony target of opportunity about 200 yards outside this no bomb area of a suspected truck park or a suspected POL, petroleum or mm-hmm. gasoline tank storage in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And what he figured out on his delivery of his weapons was that he would skip a couple of bombs off the ground and let them bounce into that cultural center. And then they would be reported as, we overshot the target,
mm-hmm.
This type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did it perfectly, turned out, and the damn thing blew up for 3 days. And nobody got in trouble.
Uh-huh.
The Chinese didn't say anything, and because that was half of the Washington's. That was half the reason it was no bomb, because they didn't want to piss off the Chinese. You know, and to me that made no sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why should we care about what they think
right.
about this?
Yeah.
But you know, it's one of those diplomatic things.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, a friend of mine emailed me, when we, where was it, Kosovo, Yugoslavia, someplace here a year or so ago, we bombed the Chinese embassy.
Yeah.
A friend of mine emailed me, and he was wondering, he said, I didn't think you were still in the service.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, he said, that looks like something you would have done. Because they mistargeted. They were supposed to be building about two blocks away.
Right.
That looked just like the one. Or very similar to the one that they ended up bombing, mm-hmm. which happened to be the Chinese embassy.
Yeah.
So this guy remembered that from 30 years ago.
That's pretty funny.
And emailed me, on it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was basically what I did every day. Just mm-hmm. do target, make up for the end. And I did briefing and debriefing. The debriefing was, I didn't do that full time. I did it sometimes. Whenever they needed another debriefer, is when they debrief the pilots when they come back from Hanoi and get bomb damage reports, reports of AAA,
mm-hmm.
how close they got shot at, and this crap that you had to send to Saigon,
mm-hmm.
and the more the better, the more whiz bang and the more explosions and the more closeness of AAA you had, the better. The weenies in Saigon loved it.
Okay.
And if you didn't produce it, they would tell you to make more.
Wow. Now, did you do any kind of photo interpretation while you were there? Would you get reconnaissance?
Yeah, we got some. There was guys that did that, but we all chipped in together. That wasn't my primary thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd get photos, come back, and we get copies of photos that would come in from the bomb damage that the several different agencies that sent us photographs every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd have reels and reels of film, and then we had a photo interpretation lab, and they would cull out the best stuff,
mm-hmm.
and then bring it and send it over to us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would, if we found anything interesting, then we would give it to the targeting officer, and then he would make a decision along with either the wing commander or one of the squadron commanders, to put it into the target mix.
Okay.
If it was something new, somebody had seen, a bunch of truck tracks going into a grove of trees somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then they'd give that a target number, and but all it had to be certain distance. You couldn't bomb. Oh, what the hell was it? 100 meters from the road.
Mm-hmm.
If anything was parked more than 100 meters from a road, you couldn't bomb it.
What?
So, oh yeah. And so they figured, okay, so we'll park it 110 meters from the road.
Mm-hmm.
See, but anyway, we ended up, you know, bombing a hell of a lot further than 110. But there were certain areas in Laos, especially, you could not bomb. You could only bomb right along the road itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that was all part of that, of the funny little rules. We always used to say, you know, when you go to enter a football game, or a basketball game, if you enter it with one hand tied behind your back and the other team has got two hands, I don't care how good you are, guess who's going to win the game.
Right.
And that's basically what, that's how it was over there.
Well.
And it was kind of frustrating
mm-hmm.
at times. But we supplemented the, you know, the working there in the shop and doing the target stuff with pretty much all of us volunteered for forward air control and for kicking flares at night along the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, we did that along with everything else.
Why don't you go ahead and describe the most interesting or scary experience you had doing that type of activity, kicking flares or?
Probably forward air the daytime forward air control was what I had was kind of pretty well nondescript. You didn't see a lot during the day because you're, you know, talking a lot jungle.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't, you'd be real lucky, to see anything moving down mm-hmm. there during the day. But at night, it was a whole completely different story. That when you're up there in the C-130 dropping flares out over the trail, it was like the 4th of July every night. Because
mm-hmm.
The ground fire coming up was, it was almost hypnotizing.
Hmm.
And very inaccurate, so there was, you know, you never did really have that much fear because nothing was ever really close to you that you thought. Probably the only scary time I had up there was, I think it was my first or second time up. They gave me a starlight scope, which mm-hmm. was the night vision scope that you could see down below, you know, like mix it like daytime.
Mm-hmm.
And you lay down beside the co-pilot. And there's a glass, curved glass in the C-130 where you could look almost straight down between the inboard engine and the fuselage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd lay down there and use that scope and look at the trail. And if I was learning how to use it and learning how to interpret what I saw, that type of thing. And one of the old sergeants on board, he said, watch for the AAA. And 37-millimeter anti-aircraft usually is either 5 or 6 shot clips. And he said, you'll see it go off. And he said, you'll see one shell following another up into the sky. And it's kind of like the stuff you saw the starlight scope photos of Baghdad.
Mm.
You know, I'm sure you saw that back then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, just stuff going up, you know, shooting, spraying up into the air, all the tracers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the way it was over there, only maybe 15% of what you saw there in the Baghdad shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, if you see all five of them in a row, he said, you know damn good and well that they're not coming at you, because if you can see five of them, you know they're angled off to see somebody.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but if you see one coming up at you, you know there's five more right behind it, and then they are heading your way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it hadn't been half an hour when he said that, and then I saw my one, and I hollered at the co-pilot. I said, they said, you holler, if you see one coming close, holler brake. And I hollered brake, and man, they rolled that C-130, and I swear to God, that shell came up right up between the engine and the fuselage, and then one of them exploded over the top of it, and you could, the shrapnel hit the top of the aircraft, and that made you pucker a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It made you feel a little more vulnerable, because before that you kind of cocky, you know, they weren't going to shoot you, it was going to be, they were shooting at somebody else, but that was my one scary moment over there.
And any incidents where people were injured or killed?
No, not then, huh? Had a little damage to the airplane,
mm-hmm.
but nobody was hurt on that flight.
Okay. We've been going for an hour now. Did you? Why don't you go ahead and discuss some of the other operations that you helped coordinate?
Okay.
In particular, I guess some of the trail bombings.
Yeah. That like that happened more in my second tour. My first tour, like we've talked, you know, the Wings mission was North Vietnam itself, and I left in March of '68. After a year there in Ubon, came back to the States, was assigned to Shaw Air Force Base, South Carolina, in a reconnaissance wing as you know, target intelligence, but it was more peacetime stuff, training. And then I volunteered, I think about a week after I got there, I volunteered to go back and to Vietnam or Thailand or wherever I happened to be. And I got my orders about 6 months later, and I went back to Thailand again, only this time it was to Udorn Air Force Base in the northern part of the country, up just south of Vientiane, Laos, about 100 miles. And that was home of the 432nd Wing, which was kind of like the 8th. They had the same mission there, but I was assigned to 7/13th Directorate of Intelligence, which was a intelligence headquarters, and I had no idea what this assignment was before I got there, and it turned out it was basically to support the war, the secret war in Laos, as they call it now, and to you know, help the Laotians fight the North Vietnamese, and again under some very, very strict rules of engagement. And pretty much everything was directed and controlled by the embassy in Vientiane, and we supported the embassy and whatever they wanted at that time. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, do you know what units in particular you were helping there in Laos? Was this in conjunction with, for instance, what Air America was doing?
Air America is, you know, they dumped what they call soft rice and hard rice. Soft rice was actually rice and food and pigs and chickens, and you know, taking food to the Hmong mountain tribes that were up there. And that were being harassed by North Vietnamese, or maybe were bottled up by whoever. And then hard rice, which was ammunition and weapons and whatever else that they were told to haul. And they did this with they were a brave bunch of bastards. Flew into places I don't think I would have flown into. But they got paid. They got paid well for the time, and many of them, a lot of those guys, I'm sure, would have done it for free. You're talking guys that all they wanted to do was fly, and they didn't. Sometimes they didn't care if they got paid for it or not. That's just, you know, they flew. That was their job, and that's what they loved to do, and they'd do it every day and 24 hours a day if they could. But Air America, of course, was doing a lot of supplying. We worked with, of course, the embassy. I worked with a gentleman named John Garrity, who's dead now. John, called him Jungle John, and he probably knew more about the war and knew more about the history of Laos and the ethnic tribes up there than anybody living. And he spent probably a total of almost 4 to 5 years over there, and he lived he lived and breathed that whole thing, and helping those people. And he's the guy that gave you your briefing and on what to expect and what you were to do. And when he got done briefing with you, you were ready to, you know, grab a gun and, you know, wade the river and go kill commies. he was that good. And but we supported the embassy, directed the war. The embassy in Laos, through the ambassador's office, basically told us what to do. And of course, they were in consultation with the Laotian government. You had three factions of the Laotian government. You had the neutralists, who were worthless. You had the Pathet Lao, who were similar to the Viet Cong in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the FAR, or the which were the loyalists,
mm-hmm.
and to the king. Seeing King, you had Prince Savannahpuma, who was actually the head of the country. And then you had the old man, the old king, up in Luang Prabang. And then you had the Royal Lao Army, which were, in some instances, pretty good troops. Not too great of fighters. Like I say, they'd rather drink rice wine and shoot at the moon than they would fight. Of course, you're talking to people that jumped from the 14th century to the 20th century real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them came out shooting crossbows and flintlock rifles, and 2 months later they were flying airplanes. That's how quick the transition was. But the person that we were helping up there the most was General Vang Pao,
mm-hmm.
who was the Hmong, ethnic Hmong. He was the only Hmong that was accepted into the Laotian army, because they have a huge, huge caste system in that country.
Mm-hmm.
You think we have discrimination here. It was worse there.
Yeah.
You have the lower in the valley you lived, why, the higher in society you were.
Mm-hmm.
And if you lived on top of the mountain, you were hillbilly, you were nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty tough for some of these old lowland generals to accept Vang Pao. But he's the only one who fought.
Okay.
The rest of them sat around and counted their medals. And he was the only one who fought. So he was the guy that we hung our hats on. I'm saying we. I'm talking with the U.S. government and mainly the CIA people handled him and got him everything he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And whether he wanted bombs, he wanted rice, he wanted food, he wanted whatever he wanted, why, it was provided for him.
Mm-hmm.
Up to 1975, when we bailed out.
Mm-hmm.
In which he, by the way, always knew we finally would.
Yeah.
If you see some of his writings.
Mm-hmm.
But he was going to take it as far as he could take it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we did out of 713th there in Udorn was to basically gather the intelligence situation from all the sources that we could, whether it be from the embassy, from air source intelligence, which was from the pilots that were actually Air Force pilots that were bombing up there, and from the Ravens, which I'm sure you've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
I worked with, in fact, I was just on the email talking with Jim Roper tonight, who's one of the top Ravens over there.
Okay.
And then one of the craziest, too.
those
guys were all six-month volunteer Air Force types, civilian clothes, discharged from the service and for 6 months, and then automatically became back in the Air Force again after 6 months. And during that 6 months, they flew in Laos.
Okay.
And we worked with them. They were the guys that were the eyes in the sky, so to speak. And they had a Lao backseater or a Hmong backseater with them at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And they would direct the ground activity against the North Vietnamese. And the Plain of Jars up there was the prime battleground during the dry season, why the North Vietnamese, who outnumbered everybody, probably 5-6 to 1, would come ripping down the roads and take the trail,
mm-hmm.
And try to take the PDJ, mm-hmm. the Plain of Jars, mm-hmm. or as much of it as they could before the rain season started. And then the rainy season, well, the roads would get bad, so they'd suck back into North Vietnam or up into the northwestern, northeastern part of Laos. And so it was a back and forth thing for, oh, I don't know how many years. You know, but toward the end, the North Vietnamese lost their sense of humor and really started putting crack divisions in there. And they were gonna take it out eventually. And they finally got tired of messing around and losing people, because the Hmong were taking a tremendous toll on them. And of course, we were at the same time in coordinate bombing, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and keeping supplies and men and everything, a certain percentage of them out of South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main. There were two missions. One was to keep Laos out of the communist hands. And the second mission was to tear the trail up and keep the North Vietnamese out of South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went on simultaneously.
Okay.
And the two got mixed up. I mean, there was overlap.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes one was you were accomplishing both missions at the same time.
Okay. What did you think about these missions and our strategy?
I thought there was more of a mission on what we were doing than what they were doing in South Vietnam.
Okay.
South Vietnam, I always knew that there was a corrupt bunch of Nguyen Cao Ky and his buddies. They were getting as much money as they could, and they were going to end up bailing out of South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the South Vietnamese forces, to a great extent, were not fighters, didn't want to fight. And there were groups of them that were very, very good,
mm-hmm.
and because they were trained to be very, very good by our people. But they didn't have any confidence in their leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Laos, there was tremendous confidence in leadership, especially the Hmong leadership. And the North Vietnamese were terrified of the Hmong. And so, they were our guys, and we had a tremendous amount of respect for them. That was probably the greatest thing that we had going for us, was all you had to do was tell them the bad guys are over there,
mm-hmm.
and they'd jump. They couldn't wait to get over there and kick butt.
Mm.
And it was such a cultural so different for them. Like I say, these kids, carrying M16s and boots, jungle boots, three or four sizes too big, and fatigues where they came down over their fingertips, and just fighting little bastards.
Mm-hmm.
And they would the CIA handle the CIA guys who were the advisors, and there were advisors, there were Army people there. The Army people are probably the last of the group of us that were there that will talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly because they were indoctrinated a little more than we were on don't tell secrets.
Mm.
Yeah, it's 30 years ago, and there's a couple of them that I know on in our TLCB that have come up, and they were really reluctant to tell what they did.
Mm. Still.
And I told them, I said, hey, let her go. And there's some great stories coming out now.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you're not going to jail.
Mm.
And that's actually what some of them are afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
They're afraid to go to jail.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, you're not going to jail. Nobody gives a hoot in hell about any of this anymore.
It happened a while ago.
Yeah, it happened a while ago. Let it go. Don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was NCOIC of the target section there at 713th and in New Dorn.
Mm-hmm.
And we were analysts. We would gather this stuff together, and then we'd make recommendations to the embassy and to the air attaché up there on what we thought was going on, and they would put that together with their other ground intelligence that they got from their you know, from people on the ground, people in the air that are actually on site. And by all of these means, why we did a pretty damn passable job of keeping a couple of North Vietnamese divisions at bay for several years.
Mm-hmm.
And lost, I think the Ravens had more, the attrition rate of the Ravens was the highest of any unit in the Air Force. Lost quite a few good guys up there.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, flying the low one bird dogs. It doesn't take much to shoot one down.
No.
And they were down, you know, running around at treetop level all the time, so it didn't have to be too good a shot to take a pot shot at them.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the, you know, and the Air America guys, you know, the movie Air America with, what's his name?
Mel Gibson.
That was about, about 15% of that was true.
Mm-hmm.
Mel Gibson movie.
Mm-hmm.
The part I hated about it was, you know, they tried to make them think, make everybody think that they were smuggling heroin,
yeah,
or whatever, opium.
Right.
They never did that.
Mm-hmm.
Was there ever opium or heroin on any of the planes that were flown by the Air America pilots? Shit, yes, there was.
Well, it was a former.
But they didn't know it.
Yeah. And
it was cargo.
I was just going to say it was cargo, but wasn't it also a form of payment they would use? Opium is in the army in Laos that were using.
Oh yeah, you had, you know, that was, you know, opium and, you know, the poppy production.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was done out in the open,
right.
And that was not, there wasn't anything illegal there.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, in the open market in Vientiane, they'd have bales of marijuana,
mm-hmm,
down there for sale.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for, you know, $20. You could buy a 100-pound bale of marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, just wasn't even, it wasn't taboo.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, you know, there was stuff that went on those airplanes that they didn't know. All they did was fly up there and open the doors, and, you know, you had a loadmaster, and even if that, or one other guy running with them, and they'd throw boxes and bags and this stuff on board. You know, they had no idea what it was.
Yeah.
And, sure, so they did carry it, but they didn't carry it for their own purposes.
No.
There was never, nobody, I guarantee you, nobody got rich in the opium and the heroin traffic, you know, in Air America over there.
No.
In fact, I think when Air America shut down, it was the only, government service of any kind ever in the history of the United States that ever returned money to the Treasury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a profitable.
20-some million dollars, I think, that they made. That,
mm-hmm,
was profits,
mm-hmm,
that they made.
Mm-hmm.
And that was turned back to the government.
Yeah.
And that's that doesn't happen very often.
No.
So, you know, it was a damn well-run,
mm-hmm,
group. But so I was... of course, worked there in Udorn, and then each of us that were worked down there, we had an opportunity to go up country into Laos, up into the mountains, into Long Chin, into Vang Pao's little secret base up there in the mountains,
mm-hmm,
for a period of time. You could only take so many. You could only have so many Americans in the country at any one time,
mm-hmm,
and this was always, believe it or not, it was counted pretty damn strictly.
Was it?
Oh yeah. It wasn't. This wasn't just on paper.
Mm-hmm.
It was because they would come to us and say, "You got to go back to Vientiane tonight because,
mm-hmm,
there's too many guys on the base." Or, you know, you can stay tonight because somebody else stayed in Vientiane, so you can stay over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was that type of thing. They counted heads, and they kept to that pretty much. I think it was. Seemed to me like it was 600, or maybe it was less than that, at any one time, total, could be in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, most of them were either embassy or, you know, CIA guys, advisors, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was 24 Ravens at any one time.
That's all?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, there was only 24. I think there was only 24 slots that they could. So you didn't have that. There wasn't that many of them up there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He had them stationed at Long Chin and Luang Prabang, the capital, and then down at Savannakhet and Pak Say, which is in the south part of the South Panhandle area of Laos.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they flew out of there, out of those bases. And but yeah, there was only a certain amount of those that could be up in the country at any one time too. So it was, yeah, it was a play. It played games.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, across the street from the U.S. Embassy, there was this building over there, and you know, you had Russian and Chinese guys over there taking pictures of you when you came in and went out. You know, especially new people, they take pictures of all the new people.
Okay.
And everybody knew that they were taking pictures, so it wasn't any big deal. But it was the Hmong and the mountain people up in Laos. They were quite a bit different than the Thais. They were a lot more serious, and which I can't blame them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were getting the crap pounded out of them.
Yeah.
And they had a mission. They were there to chase off the North Vietnamese, who, you know, historically and ethnically, there's a lot of hatred between them, because
mm-hmm.
the Hmong were also were cousins of the Montagnards in South Vietnam. A lot of the same dress, same language, really, in certain areas. I guess you could, certain ones of the villages could understand each other.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in Laos itself, there was something like 100 and some different dialects.
Wow.
So, you know, people on one side of a valley could go across the mountain down to another valley and couldn't understand the guys over there.
Mm-hmm.
That's how isolated everything is, because there's not a railroad track in Laos to this day, and very few roads. It's just a very isolated little place. Beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. Yeah, great place.
Mm-hmm. Did you get much of a chance to interact with the CIA people or the Ravens? Or
the Ravens, yeah. They'd come down to Udorn. We'd brief them. They'd come down there maybe once a month to talk to us and, you know, ask us questions. And we'd give them infos, what was going on. And then a lot of it was us getting information from them, because they were the guys that were up there, you know, doing. They were the guys that had firsthand stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was... we learned as much from them as they did from us.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, these were a crazy batch.
Mm-hmm.
They were, you know, party tonight for tomorrow you may die, whatever that
mm-hmm.
whatever that saying is.
Yeah.
And they did that.
Okay.
They had they had what they called the Raven Hooch up at Long Chin, and had a bar in there. And there was always somebody in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just going 24 hours a day. And then you had guys like the other guy you should get a hold of, a guy named Fred Platt.
Oh, yeah.
You know Fred?
I met him. He's, isn't he instrumental in trying to get that China Post 1
going? Yeah, right. Yeah,
yeah.
He's the adjutant for China Post number 1.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, I met him at the Air America reunion.
Every time he'd come into our place, it was just you could feel him coming for probably two or three blocks. I mean, he had that much of his personality.
Uh-huh.
When he'd come busting through the door, the one story about him I remember, he came busting in the door one day and he had his party suit on, and I think he was probably hungover. And he said, "Where's the colonel?" And I said, "Well, he's probably in his office." He walked in the colonel's office, you know, no salute or nothing. And that's Fred. And he said, "Colonel," he said, "I need to get a medal. I need you to authorize a medal." And I could hear him talking. And the colonel says, "Fred, what are you talking about? What medal?" And he said, "I don't know." He said, "Bronze Star." He said, "Something for bravery." And the colonel said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "Well, he was up around, flying out of Luang Prabang."
Mm-hmm.
And along the Mekong, and there was some barges there full of whatever. And my Fred put some, called some fast movers in up there, and he put some smoke rockets in on it. And the jets came in and, you know, dropped their ordnance. And, of course, they couldn't hit anything with it. But the concussion would break this barge loose from its mooring and start floating out into the river. And Fred said, there's a little guy that'd come up out of his spider hole, and he'd run just as fast as he could down there, and he'd grab the rope, and he'd pull this barge back and tie it up. And just about that time, well, here come the jets again, and he'd dive back into his little hole, and the bombs would go off, and the same thing had happened. He said this happened three or four times,
mm-hmm.
that this barge would get blown away from the dock, and this little guy would run down there and grab it and tie it up. And he said, I want you to authorize a medal for this guy. He said, that's the bravest little son of a bitch I ever saw in my life. Colonel threw him out of the office.
Yeah.
But that was kind of crap that Fred called him, you know, crash or magnet ass.
Magnet ass.
Because I think he had either, I'm thinking 10 planes shot out from under him.
Wow.
And the last one was the only time, the last crash he had was the only time he got hurt, and that's he hurt his neck. I think he broke his neck or something.
That's awfully lucky.
He was in a neck brace for quite a few months, and they wouldn't let him fly again. They finally said, that's enough, and they sent him home.
Uh-huh.
Because he was, and he went kicking and screaming, because he's one of those kind of guys that would have stayed there till he got killed,
uh-huh.
if he hadn't have, because he was having way too much fun.
Okay.
But if you got to meet him, well, you met one of the characters.
Uh-huh.
Now some of the other Raven guys that are a little quieter, a little
uh-huh.
more thoughtful,
uh-huh.
Don't like Fred too much.
Uh-huh.
He's not liked by everybody.
Yeah.
And of the old Ravens, and mainly because it's just his personality.
Mm-hmm.
He just raise hell constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And he ruffled some feathers too. So, but I always liked him. He always treated me well. But I got to know him and Jim Roper, who's probably one of the better ones that was over there. One of the real nice guys. And he's a little bit wild and crazy too, but not quite as crazy as Fred.
Okay.
The CIA guys always kept away. You didn't know who was CIA and who wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
One guy there that I found out was CIA, I thought he was Air America, because they kind of intermingled
mm-hmm.
in the same compound there in Udorn.
Okay.
And they were always in and out of there. And his name was Tom Lum, and he was Chinese-American.
Mm-hmm.
And he could pass for a Thai or a Lao, and he had more fun going downtown to the bars and sitting around and talking to people, because they always thought he was a native. But it turned out he was CIA. And nice guy. One of the few guys that I met that would actually talk to you. Most of the CIA types that I saw were young. I called them Yalies.
Mm.
Far East Asian master's degrees in Far East Asian affairs out of Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't know Sikkim.
Mm.
And they stayed in their little bunker. And, we were sat around and said, here, these are the guys that are running the war, got their Yale rings on. And, these are guys that are actually running this place. But they did to a certain extent, but, the embassy was actually the power. The embassy in Vientiane
mm-hmm.
that's where everything started and ended. It was quite an active place.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much information would you get about what was happening in Vietnam?
While
you were in Thailand?
While I was there, very little. Very little. Hardly ever. I don't remember. Oh, there was sit reps, and there was reports, from DIA and Army and Navy and Air Force, stuff that came through, daily.
Mm-hmm.
But we just really didn't pay any attention to it up there. Now, when I was in Ubon with the 8th, that was a different story. We kind of knew what was going on in South Vietnam to a certain extent, and always what was going on in North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That was our focus.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was at the second tour, we didn't know what was going on in South Vietnam, and we really didn't care, because it wasn't our war.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know, we didn't have any idea what was going on over there. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever mentioned anything of what was going on, and because we were doing our thing up there.
Mm-hmm. You didn't have much access to newspapers?
I'm sorry?
Did you have much access to newspapers? American print newspapers or English language?
No. Bangkok Post out of Bangkok. We got that every day. Mm-hmm. It was good paper. It was a pretty good paper. And it told, every once in a while there'd be a headline in there about something that was going on in Laos or something going on in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had snuck out of Laos. And it may be a little secret thing, but every once in a while they'd print it. New York Times, mm-hmm. I think we got it. I used to read it once in a while. I got the Sunday Times. That would come into the office, one of the offices over there.
Mm-hmm.
And Time and Newsweek, U.S. News World Report, we always got those over there. And that's probably about it as far as U.S. stuff.
Hmm. And what about news from home?
Always letters, letters from my parents, and once in a while for some friends and classmates when I was in high school. But mainly just letters from mom and dad and my brothers. I had two younger brothers that ended up getting the Army National Guard.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. Neither one of them had to go to over the Vietnam area.
Mm-hmm.
But, basically letters probably, once every couple of weeks there was a letter.
And was your mail scrutinized rather heavily when you tried to write home? Or?
My parents never said anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know theirs, of course, wasn't coming to me. But mine, we were told not to say anything about, any specifics about either particularly where we were or, what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And just a precautionary thing.
Mm-hmm.
My folks knew I was in Thailand because, I'd send pictures,
mm-hmm.
Bangkok and, the Buddhas and all the temples and everything down there. I sent a lot of photographs home.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about all they knew.
Were there any compromises while you were there? Intelligence compromises?
I'm sure there were. I know that at Ubon there was somebody. They had a little ring going there in Ubon because when Robin Olds would take off, especially toward the end of his tour,
mm-hmm.
when he would take off and try to go to Hanoi to get his fifth MiG, he wasn't even out of sight. And Hanoi Hannah would come on the radio and she'd say, Robin, you're not going to get that MiG today because we're not going to come up and fight you. And, you're not going to get that. We're not going to let you be an ace.
Wow.
I mean, that was that quick. Mm-hmm. Intelligence was that quick.
Mm-hmm.
So there was, they had some inside people there. But as far as any kind of an intelligence breach up at Udorn, or for the matter of fact, Ubon, I don't. If it was, it was covert, and we wouldn't have known it was a breach anyway. Because
mm-hmm.
it was everything was really kind of in some ways it was kind of loosey goosey. There was security, and there was don't ask, don't tell, need to know type situations there, but. We had a sneaking suspicion that, most everybody knew what we were doing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the American people maybe not have known,
mm-hmm.
But the Russians and Chinese sure as hell did.
Mm-hmm. And, let's see. What about the black market? Was that a problem where you were?
No. Like I say, I think I mentioned before, a quart of whiskey out of the NCO club would, get you a weekend in a taxi.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably about as strong as it got over there.
Hmm.
There wasn't any shortages of anything.
Okay.
In Thailand. Thailand was, it was a peaceful country and, You know, they weren't fighting anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like, you know, South Vietnam was, rampant in corruption and stealing everything they could get their hands on.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't even tell you that we didn't get stuff stolen off the base there.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't to the degree that happened in the bases in South Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't. I never ran on any black market activities. I suppose maybe cigarettes, if you could say that was a black market thing.
Mm-hmm. And now you mentioned that. Let's see here, you gathered intelligence from sources.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of sources?
Oh, we, like I say, we get it from, a lot of it came from, over the wire. And, you take one piece of intelligence, or one piece of information,
mm-hmm.
And it may not mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get a piece of information from here and one from there, and you put them all three together,
mm-hmm.
and it means something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we did. It was, That's one of the things we did, and then we got human intelligence also. I had I worked a Thai artillery advisor.
Mm-hmm.
He was a master sergeant in the Thai artillery, and I was I was living with his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to be pretty good friends, but he was going up into Laos, and he let me know. Not directly, but indirectly, that's where he'd go about every couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started using him as an intelligence source. He didn't, I don't think he knew what I was doing with it,
mm-hmm.
or even that I was using him. But I just casually, sitting there drinking beer, and we'd talk about this and say, where were you this week? And he'd say, I was up north. And then he'd let slip every once in a while maybe the name of an outfit or the name of a town.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd take that the next day and turn it in, and we'd look at it. And the problem that we had, there was a division between the Army and the Air Force, and it was supposed to have been coordinated by the embassy, but a lot of times there were still gaps where we didn't know what the Army was doing.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have a clue.
But you're talking about the Thai Army or the U.S. Army?
The U.S. Army advisors up there.
Okay.
What they were doing on the ground, actually physically on the ground,
mm-hmm.
There was names of the operations that they'd have, and we'd get after a while you'd get, let's say, Operation Donald Duck or
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after a couple of weeks, and you knew that probably there was something going on in a particular area that they were doing some fighting over there,
mm-hmm.
and it was either Lao or Hmong. With the Army or Marine advisors. But it took a long time to figure this out.
Mm-hmm.
And because we didn't have any real direct contacts,
mm-hmm.
In other words, the Army didn't copy us when they sent their reports in.
Yeah.
And it would have been a hell of a lot easier if they would have, because we ended up having to get the situation of what they were doing either through the embassy a week late, or doing a little something like what I did, having a guy that was actually going up there,
mm-hmm.
and so we'd put stuff together, and one of our jobs was also to analyze what was happening, and then make reports, and those reports went to some of them went to Saigon, although Saigon really wasn't interested in what we had to say. Just like we weren't interested in what was going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
As far as they were concerned, we were over in Laos doing something and nobody knew what it was and didn't care and didn't want to know.
Hmm. Did that bother you or any of your other fellow airmen? I mean, there didn't seem to be a whole lot of cooperation sometimes between the branches of American services.
Yeah. At that time, up and you don't know, it really didn't bother us because we were our own little family. We were our own little group.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying group, of what are, several hundred people involved in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we all felt, kind of like a family, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at Ubon, and Robin Olds would tell you the same thing, that there was a tremendous amount of cooperation between Navy and Air Force,
mm-hmm.
And Marines during on the Marine pilots,
mm-hmm.
Anybody that flew an airplane,
mm-hmm.
You know, during that period.
Okay.
They helped each other out. There was some, you know, there was some inter-service rivalries. There always are.
Right.
And this type of thing, you know, my plane's better than your plane,
mm-hmm.
type of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, bragging rights in the bar, mm-hmm. or in the old club,
mm-hmm.
and that type of thing. It always goes on, you know, bragging rights and strutting around rooster stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, but there was a lot of cooperation there. Now at Udorn, where I was, I think the lack of if I had to put a finger on why there sometimes wasn't we didn't know everything or didn't find out everything we should have known, but I think the CIA had a pretty tight lid on a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
And they put a minimal list out of who needed to know what,
mm-hmm.
each day.
Okay.
And there were a couple people behind a green door,
mm-hmm.
in our area that knew everything. And they'd kind of let us know sometimes about something that was going on that maybe we couldn't find out another way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see here. We've been going almost 2 hours. What about drug use? Did you witness any in your unit while you were there? Or units?
I saw my... let's see, was it Ubon? Yeah, Ubon. Never was around it. There was, of course, marijuana everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I just never ran with the guys that smoked it. My Samlar driver... got a little tricycled pedicab type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I asked him for a cigarette one night, and that's what he handed me.
Mm-hmm.
Handed me a joint.
Mm-hmm.
And in the dark, I thought it was a Camel because they rolled them like Camel cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
They were pretty professionally done. Thought it was awful damn strong, but I felt pretty good there after a while.
Okay.
But there was marijuana there at Ubon, and there may have been stronger stuff too. I never ran into it. We had a 702, which is a admin clerk from Detroit, that was constantly in trouble while he was there.
Mm-hmm.
And when he left, got rotated back to the States, he said, I'm gonna have a lot of money when I get back to the States. And nobody paid any attention to him. Well,
mm-hmm.
what he had done, the stupid idiot, was, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before you ship back, you pack what's called hold baggage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a 2-foot by 2-foot by 4-foot pine box. You know, and you stick your stereo that you bought over there, or, you know, stuff that you can't carry on the airplane.
Right.
And you pack it all up, and the Air Force sends it to your house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's waiting for you when you get home. Well, he packed his full of marijuana. And, of course, when he got back to Travis, there was a couple of guys waiting for him,
mm-hmm.
there. So he, I think he spent the rest of his tour in jail somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But at Udorn, we worked... we worked with the OSI up there, the Office of Special Investigations. We knew some of those guys, and
mm-hmm.
just to keep the boredom down, there was an Army base up north of town called Ramathon, which is a radar station. And there was also a Coast Guard, believe it or not, radar station up there. And both of these were notorious potheads,
mm-hmm.
bases.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got a lot of, we didn't like the Army guys anyway, so those are the ones we got busted.
Mm-hmm.
We get them busted, and the Navy, the Coast Guard guys, They had a lieutenant, J.G., I think it was their boss, and he was the biggest pothead of all of them.
Wow.
And he was stoned all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they didn't have any supervision up there, so I don't know what happened there. But we got a lot of guys thrown off base and moved around in different areas and broke up groups. But it was all marijuana. I never saw any or heard of any, opium or heroin, which would have been easy,
mm-hmm.
Because you're right there next to it.
Okay.
Maybe I was naive, but I was just never in the groups that mess with that stuff.
Mm-hmm. What about alcohol use?
Now, there was a different story. that was a daily thing.
Mm-hmm.
Probably by, 80%.
Mm.
I'm guessing we maybe drank.
Mm-hmm.
40% probably drank to excess.
Mm.
And he just went, we drank on the base. We'd go to the NCO club, Airman's club,
mm-hmm.
drink beer. It's cheap, dime
yeah.
a can.
Yeah.
What can you do?
Right.
And we go to the package store, the liquor store. And, I'd buy, I'm a Scotch drinker, so I'd buy, Chivas Regal Royal Salute, which was costing $35 or $40 a bottle in the States at that time. You get it for $5.
Mm-hmm.
So, we drank good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, we go downtown and we drink a lot of local beer. Singhai was the beer in Thailand that everybody drank, and I still like it if I can find it. It's tough to find over here.
Mm-hmm.
I know my tour in Udorn, that's a little neighborhood bar that I frequented, and I came in liter bottles over there. That's how they sold it, liter bottles. So I drank two or three of those a night,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes maybe four. That's a lot of beer.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to feeling pretty bad, feeling real sluggish, so I went to the infirmary and talked to the doc over there, and he was a pretty cool doctor, and he gave me some blood tests and things like that, and he said, you drinking local beer? And I said, yeah. And he said, is that Singhai? And I said, yeah. And he said, how much? And I told him, and he said, well, you crazy fool. He said, they ate that stuff with formaldehyde.
Oh, goodness.
And he said, you're slowly pickling yourself.
Oh.
So he put me on a gallon of water a day I had to drink for 30 days to flush myself out.
Yeah.
Couldn't drink any beer for 30 days. And, I felt like I got to feeling pretty good after a while, but
uh-huh.
but he said that formaldehyde was staying in you. It didn't get out of the system.
Wow.
And for a while, anyway.
Yeah.
And so he said, he looked at me and he said, you crazy fool, you're pickling yourself.
Wow.
But, it was, that's what you did.
Uh-huh.
You got off work, you drank.
Yeah.
And because it was cheap and it was allowable.
Mm-hmm.
And you get drunk. Now, that's another stuff. I mean, you get drunk and fall down and have the air police, you get in their way or get in their faces, then that's a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Because mainly they were mad because they were on duty and couldn't drink.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got, there was a lot of harassment there, too. But.
Mm.
But it was only if you got completely out of control.
Yeah. Did that happen very frequently?
Oh yeah, there was some of the ratty bars, and every little base had them. You got a little section always where you had the nasty places,
mm-hmm.
and where just like in the civilian world,
mm-hmm.
You got the biker bars or places where lowlifes hang out.
Right.
Military is not any different.
Nope.
Those places attract the low lives in the military,
mm-hmm.
and so there, there was always fights in those places,
mm-hmm.
and people got hurt. But me and my group, we have some places that we went that, in fact, if anybody came in and caused trouble, usually a couple, three of us, they were out the door, and were not welcome back again.
Okay.
And so we kind of policed our own area,
mm-hmm.
and we'd have guys try to move in on you. You'd come in and walk, and they'd case the joint and try to figure out if that's where they wanted them and their buddies to go. And you knew what these people were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they were never successful. So, and some of the Thai bar owners, they knew which kind of people they wanted to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose in some of the rattier places, that's where you, if you were going to find a drug or something other than marijuana, that's probably where you'd find it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of bars, you know, a lot of little bars, some little holes in the wall, some of them more nightclubby, you know, some of them open air type,
mm-hmm.
patio type bars, and but dance bands and, you know, local Thai bands and singing American songs and broken English,
mm-hmm.
and you know, a lot of fun.
What about racial issues, racial problems?
I was a little bit of tension. At Ubon, I didn't see any. At Udorn, 2 years later in 69 and 70,
mm-hmm.
that's when I was there.
Mm-hmm.
You were starting to see some of them come over from the States, black guys that were had the afros.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pushing the military haircut standard right to the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And they were always, you know, they were getting in trouble because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were told to get a haircut. And once in a while, one of them didn't want to. And, you know, so you had an Article 15 or whatever the kind of judicial punishment that you have on a situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but as far as racial incidents, between black and white, in the airmen. Now the NCO club was different because most when I got up to the rank of sergeant, I went over to the NCO club quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 60% of the guys in there were probably career,
mm-hmm.
Career NCOs, and you didn't see the division between races,
okay.
in the club as far as seating arrangement. Airman's Club, you had pretty much the blacks on one side and the whites on another.
Hmm.
You know, they just had their little own, you know, they had their own group, their own people, their own, of course, the music that they wanted to hear,
mm-hmm.
and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a natural division or not. I had a couple of black friends that, over there that they wouldn't even go sit with them. They'd sit with us.
Hmm.
They didn't didn't want to mess with it.
Okay.
But we had quite a few black guys in my outfit, and all pretty nice guys.
Mm-hmm.
Had one admin clerk that born and raised in Detroit, and I noticed he had a lot of scars on his back, and he was I guess he came from a pretty hellish neighborhood. And he said when he joined the Air Force came in a bus to take him out to the recruiting.
Mm-hmm.
And the bus had, you know, chicken wire on the windows,
mm-hmm.
To keep from throwing rocks through it.
Yeah.
And he was terrified going out of there because his gang had a particular turf, and he had never been more than three or four blocks from his house or the school his entire life.
Wow.
And he knew he was going to be killed even on that bus when they went out of the neighborhood to the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And he said until he got on the plane, he was fearing for his life. This shows you what, you know, cultures of people that you run into in the military.
Yeah.
You know, they're from all over.
Mm-hmm.
They're from everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you'd have and they on purpose did some things the Air Force did. I know in Beale Air Force Base, we had a white kid from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Reginald Temple III, and he was plantation white. I mean, old-time plantation white.
Hmm.
And the first thing he said when he walked into the barracks there in this 1966, with his duffel bag over his shoulder, he said, "Which side of this building do the N-word sleep on?" And there was about six guys from Detroit and Brooklyn, black ones, sitting in the day room watching TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they all stood up real slow and turned around and looked at who was this fool?
Mm-hmm.
And the first sergeant ended up putting this white kid from Mississippi in a room with a black kid from Detroit. and it took 3 weeks for the fight to occur. And it was a Donnybrook.
Mm-hmm.
And you wouldn't think this little skinny white kid from Mississippi could hold a candle to, I mean, this guy from Detroit was a Mike Tyson type.
Mm.
And they fought for a half an hour.
Wow.
Punched holes through the walls. The sheetrock was crushed. And they came out of there, and from that time on, they were best of friends. So there was a method in the madness there.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, outside of a few, a little bit of authority type things as far as racial incidents between blacks and whites there at Udorn servicemen, I didn't see it.
Mm-hmm.
There was some racial animosity between the locals.
Mm.
And I'm saying this very honestly, it was a racial thing over there. A lot of the Thais did not like blacks.
Interesting. Did you know the basis of that?
Huh?
Do you know the basis for that?
Because of their skin color.
It was because they were dark.
Mm-hmm. Because they were dark.
Okay.
Because the Thais, we were always sitting around trying to get tans, you know.
Yeah.
And the workers, the local workers, would be walking around either, you know, digging ditches or something, and they'd, because I got to understand the language pretty well,
mm-hmm.
still speak it pretty good today.
And mm-hmm.
They'd be talking to each other like, you know, what are these stupid foreigners
uh-huh.
over there trying to get dark,
uh-huh.
you know, because
okay.
they would sit over there with umbrellas on trying to stay out of the sun,
right.
And they'd lighten up.
Yeah.
And they couldn't understand why we always wanted to get tans, because that was, to them, the whiter the skin, the better. But, there was a few incidents there, and once in a while you get an incident, you know, between a white and a Thai, and
uh-huh.
mainly it was there was some what they call Thai Kong
uh-huh.
around the area. They would come in very very few and cause some trouble.
What does that mean, Thai Kong?
They were like Viet Cong.
Taiwanese,
yeah.
Thailand
yeah.
communists.
Yeah, and they call them Thai Kong, and they lived up in the mountains, and they'd come around the perimeters of the bases from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Just before I got to Udorn, they'd had an incident where some of them came through the perimeter and threw some hand grenades and tried to run away, and all of them got killed.
Mm-hmm.
The air police nailed them.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have a chance, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, other than that, I really didn't witness a lot of racial incidents at all.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think about your commanders, your leaders?
Always had good guys as commanders.
Mm-hmm.
As far as my direct bosses, never had a problem with any of them. They were all, mostly my bosses were all staff officers,
mm-hmm.
they had been pilots,
mm-hmm.
or were pilots, and so they were air crew types. That had, you know, they've all, when you're a career like that, you've got to pull what they call staff duty,
mm-hmm.
at least one tour,
mm-hmm.
And sit behind a desk for a year before they let you fly an airplane again or be a navigator or whatever they happen to be.
Mm-hmm.
And most of all, our guys were rated pilots. And they're a completely different breed.
Mm-hmm.
Never really had a bad one.
Okay.
There's some career paper pusher types,
mm-hmm.
Officers that were you know, assholes,
mm-hmm.
but you avoided them, and so did everybody. Even the other officers avoided them too.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just they were always looking for somebody to jump on. But the Air Force was a different service than the other ones, and I think you asked me why I wanted to join it, but, you know, I didn't find out till I was in it that. The Air Force is the only service, at least in the when I was in it,
mm-hmm.
that you went to work, you did your duty, did your job from 8 to 5 or from midnight to 7 or from, you know, midnight to noon, whatever your time was,
mm-hmm.
and then you worked side by side with the officers. And it was yes sir, no sir, and you had your uniform on, you did your job.
Mm-hmm.
After you got off duty, it was, if they were junior grade officers, it was Bill and Charlie and Joe.
Mm-hmm.
And you went drinking together. And, you know, if it was a field grade officer, I always, you know, you just get in the habit of calling him sir.
Yeah.
And you didn't call a full colonel, you know, hey Bob, come over here.
Mm-hmm.
If he happened to be your, you know, big commander.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, but, you know, he went, ate together and went downtown to restaurants and you know, drank beer and, you know, and chased girls if that's what you wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next morning it was yes or no, sir, again.
Mm-hmm.
And the Army and the Marines and the Navy, I know we ran into some Marines one time. This was an Ubon.
Mm-hmm.
Had a captain that was in my office. Hell of a nice guy, Air Force Academy graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill, can't think of his name, last name, told jokes all the time, never heard the same one twice.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up. The officers' club happened to be across the street from the base swimming pool, and then they had a snack bar and a place where you could play cards. And after work one day, he said, "Let's go eat tonight." And he said, "I'm going to go to the O Club and have a couple of drinks." And I said, "Well, I'll just go over and get a beer over at the pool." And I said, "I'll meet you out here at 6 o'clock, whatever, 7 o'clock in the evening." So we met in the middle of the street, and he was one of these touchy-feely kind of guys. He put his arm around your shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, grab your arm or something like that.
Yeah.
And so he'd come out of the building, and, of course, he'd had a couple of pops. And and he threw his arm around my shoulder, and he said, "Boy, let me tell you the ones I just heard tonight." He started telling me jokes. Well, all of a sudden we heard this, you know, "As you were, gentlemen," you know, looked up, and there was this goddamn Marine major standing there.
Mm-hmm.
In full uniform.
Mm-hmm.
Just glaring.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill said, "Sir," he said, "what can I help you?" And he said, "You know, it's against the rules." He started chewing butt, you know, because for an officer and enlisted man to walk down the street together.
Mm.
And he said, especially with, you know, the officer had an arm over the shoulder of the enlisted man. And Bill said, he looked at me and he said, "Sarge?" And he said, I said, "Yeah." I said, "Yes, Captain, what do you want?" He said, "Do you want to hit him first or do you want me to?" And this major just blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he got our names and he got our serial numbers. And, you know, we gave him and said he was going to turn us into the base commander and all this stuff, you know. And we said, "You go right ahead, Major." He said, "We'll just, in fact, if you want to come down to the office tomorrow morning at 06 Center, we'll introduce you to the colonel and you can give him your complaint right there."
Mm-hmm.
And the guy spun on his heel and went away. But that's that was one of the things that I enjoyed about the Air Force, that it was businesslike, but yet you know, the old hardcore military division between enlisted and officers wasn't that great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I went on a Navy base in San Diego to get paid one time. You know, if you get your pay slip with you and you run out of money, if it's payday, well, you can go get paid anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked onto that base and I asked the SP there where, you know, where personnel was to get paid, and he pointed the building out to me. Well, all of a sudden I walked up the building and they had two doors on it. One said enlisted, one said officers.
Mm-hmm.
And they had two hallways, you know, parallel to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in the officer's door. And it just made me so angry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that I had never seen that before. Didn't. And it's, I'm glad I didn't join the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
But we had, there was always, you know, you get in trouble, in the Air Force. But, you know, we had this, you worked hard and you worked with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it wasn't unusual to see, to go downtown. With even your commander at time, although the commanders usually kind of pulled off to the side, you know, there was a certain protocol
mm-hmm.
that they had to keep up.
Mm-hmm. You didn't think that familiarity between officers and enlisted could breed contempt? You know, that old cliche, familiarity bleep.
No, well, I suppose maybe it could in other situations. In our situation, it didn't. I know the saying.
Yeah.
But no, it didn't. In fact, there was always a lot of encouragement. You know, we had a job to do there, and when you're in a in a war zone. Now, back in civilian life here in duty in the States, yeah, it could be because there's always somebody, that wants to spoil the pot. Somebody looking for promotion or, you know, other, whatever their agenda happens to be. And, but in war zone, even though we weren't in, you know, in a war being shot at every day, the base, it was peaceful around the bases there. We were still in a war situation, even though we were, you know, flying across the river to do that war. And then the guys would fly over and come back and sleep in air conditioning barracks every night. And, you know, which was a little, you know, I don't know, there's, you can visualize that, but that happened a lot. And, but we just, we all knew what our job was, and we all worked together, and they, you know, we all pulled. I mean, it was just like, it was team. It was a teamwork thing, just pure and simple. And anybody that was, and we had some arrogant officers come through there, young, cocky, brown bar lieutenants right out of ROTC trying to make a name for themselves. And we usually, they usually got put down real quick. They learned that, at least while they were at our place, that you didn't pull rank. You didn't. If you pulled it, it had to be for a hell of a good reason. And you worked together as a team, and not as individuals. You know, officers standing up there telling enlisted men what to do, because 99% of the time, the enlisted men knew more than the officers. You'll find that in about any military, that you find a good old master sergeant, he's forgotten more than three or four captains sitting there with him. And usually a smart officer will defer. And that's the ones that got along well, is the one that deferred to that top kick, that top sergeant, or that person that knew more than they did. So they learned from them, made them better officers.
Would you give a percentage or an estimate? How frequently would you run into Air Force officers that didn't appreciate or didn't go along with that policy of fraternization off when you weren't in the office?
And Air Force officers?
Yeah.
I probably ran into two in my entire time in the service.
Wow.
Two or three, maybe, that were had a little chip on their shoulder. And one of those was a former enlisted man, believe it or not, but who had somehow gotten into OTS, and don't know how he did, because he was worthless, and everybody knew he was worthless, but somehow he was he'd been in like 8 years and was a tech sergeant or something like that, and somehow got into officer training. He got his degree or something, but he was a worthless officer. But he was kind that was real sensitive to rank. And, of course, when you went down the street, you know, you saluted the officers, and 99% of them would, if you didn't salute them, why, they'd say something. And some of them would, I know a couple officers didn't like to be saluted at. You know, they'd, before you'd salute, I said, "That's okay. How you doing?" And they'd actually speak up first. And I enjoyed saluting, you know, and I enjoyed the return salute, especially if it was a snappy one. Some of them are pretty poor saluters. I always prided myself in my salute, and I always liked to get one in return that was just as good. And you find that most ones that kind of took it a little bit serious, on, that you enjoyed returning a salute just as good as the one you gave.
Okay. Let me go ahead and stop this recorder, because it's going to run out of tape. So this will end tape CD1, excuse me.
It ran you out, huh?
Yes, sir. This is Steve Maxner, continuing the interview with Mr. Larry Klum on the 29th of August, year 2000. This is CD number 2. All right, Mr. Klum, would you? Was there anything else that you wanted to discuss with regard to your service in Southeast Asia?
The only thing that I was And I might mention that normally the tour is 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
My second tour, which started, like I say, in March of 69 at Udorn, with the, that's where we were helping the Hmong and the little war up in Laos,
mm-hmm.
is that we got pretty involved in it. All of us did. We were it was a cause for us. It was for everybody concerned. And I think maybe down deep we knew that eventually our little guys were going to lose,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't really want to think about that.
Okay.
We knew that Washington D.C. was going to be of no help. So we, had to do what we had to make do with what we had.
Mm-hmm.
And I was supposed to be discharged in March of 70. And I finagled a way to extend my tour and extend my enlistment 6 months. Because at that point, I didn't want to leave. We were in the middle of another one of the battles up in the PDJ, and our little guys were in trouble, and we were trying to find ways to keep the North Vietnamese at bay for another season, another dry season. And it's just you get caught up in it, and at least we did. And I don't know of a person that I was ever over there with that didn't feel the same way I did.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the guys in the TLCB that were, they weren't stationed with me. They were in other bases. They were over at NKP, Nakhon Phanom, or Naked Fanny, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were involved in a lot of special operations in Laos, similar to what we did. Only they were actually, the airplanes were, the props and the T-28s and the old prop planes and a lot of search and rescue missions. And those guys got caught up in the same type of situation, different cause, different area maybe, but they were all, they had the same attitude and feelings that I did,
mm-hmm.
and my friends did, and so I didn't want to leave, so I extended my enlistment, as I said, for 6 months and then my tour, so I didn't get discharged till August the 2nd of 1970.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was that teamwork, and that in the military you got the camaraderie, and the job well done, and everybody working together, and you get some kind of a fulfillment out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what all of us were looking for, was some way to kind of, I don't know if you would justify what we were doing, but we really enjoyed our work, and everybody that had to go home was real reluctant to go home. It wasn't, get me on that plane, I'm out of here,
mm-hmm.
because they felt that they were kind of leaving behind a job undone,
mm-hmm.
and or not finished.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, all of us were like that, and I wasn't any different than 90% of the rest of them. And it wasn't just unique with me. That was a feeling of a lot of the people over there.
Mm-hmm. When you left, what did you think about the situation in Southeast Asia in particular?
I had to basically catch up with what was going on in South Vietnam, mm-hmm. and when I left. Left over there in August of 70. Why? To back up a little bit, between tours, when I was at Shaw Air Force Base from March of 68 to March of 69, there was starting the real turbulent period here.
Mm.
The protests, the Democratic Convention,
mm-hmm.
in 68.
Mm-hmm.
I sat there and watched that on TV. And saw the huge, war protests. So when I went back for my second tour, I was, well aware of what had been going on in the States.
Mm-hmm.
So, you forgot about that when you went over there.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't even think about it. At least I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I left, and got discharged in August of 70, I was glad to get home. Mm-hmm. I was homesick, and that 18 months was a long time, now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an opportunity to go to officer's training school, because I was a college graduate, even though, you know, I was went in as an enlisted guy. And they tried to get me to go to OCS. And I think if I'd have come home for 30 or 45 days and relaxed and thought about it a while, I probably would have made a career of the Air Force.
Hmm.
But I didn't. And but coming home, I didn't really talk to anybody about Vietnam much, because I didn't want to get in the discussions with them.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have anybody ever spit on me.
Mm-hmm.
I know I got friends that did. When they got off the plane, or when they got into San Francisco from Travis,
mm-hmm.
I know several got a lot of guys that got spit on.
Mm.
One guy got his head split open, had a concussion, spent 6 months in the hospital because somebody sucker punched him with a beer bottle, right down on Market Street in San Francisco as he was getting into a taxi cab. But I never did have any run-ins or any of the protesters at all. But I didn't, I still thought that, as far as my attitude, whether we should be there or not be there, I still had a feeling at that time that we still had a mission and a cause.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't get caught up in any of the criticism of the government, criticism of the policy at that point, or?
No.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
When did you ever?
Not really. In discussing it now with guys in the TLCB, I was always reluctant to do any of the criticism, but I found that there was people that were doing the same thing I did and felt just as patriotic and about serving their country,
mm-hmm.
as I did. Over there, and that say it was now they say it was a waste of time, and I reluctantly, you know, I find myself saying, "Yeah, it kind of was," you know, it was kind of, but I didn't really want to tell myself that because, like, maybe it's because I didn't want to think that my time over there was a waste.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's a bunch of us that still, you know, General Olds, when he was giving us his speech, you know, he. You know, he says, you know, everything that happened, he said that, he said that damn war.
Mm.
A damn war that we should have never been in. And he said, because nobody gave a damn about it then, and they don't now. And so, you know, here was the guy that was my hero,
mm-hmm.
saying the thing that I didn't really want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And which I knew was kind of true, but, I was looking at it from a personal standpoint that, you know, I did my duty, I wanted to do it, and I was glad I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would do it again in a heartbeat. But, you know, was the cause just? You know, at that time, yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was just, and I still think it was in a certain way, although they didn't let us win the war. I think if they would have, because I know the civilian side of it, it was not a war that they're going to go over and defeat a particular people. All this was to be to stalemate the thing and to mark time, and they did it successfully for, you know, 15 years, whatever.
Do you think the sacrifices made were worth what we gained?
Well, that's one of the things we discussed. I don't know what we didn't gain anything. Laos turned communist. South Vietnam turned communist.
Mm-hmm.
That pretty well, you know, puts it in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't battles. We won every major battle that we fought over there. But you end up losing the war because the leaders don't want to win the war. And we're a country that is the military is subservient to the civilian rule,
mm-hmm.
and that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And if we wanted a military-type country take it over, we probably could have gone over there and kick butt for about 6 or 8 months, and taken over South and North Vietnam
mm-hmm.
if they would have had a land-type war without the restrictions and rules that would. And China, you know, may or may not have come into it, but the Chinese hate the Vietnamese more than the Vietnamese hated us at the time, so. Because you know the Vietnamese hate the Chinese, always have, and so they probably would have been. Then the Russians would have raised more hell and did at times
mm-hmm.
than the Chinese ever did.
Mm-hmm.
We always got more static from the Russians than we ever did the Chinese when we were over there. But so we didn't really gain anything. Well, we gained a hell of a lot of experience
mm-hmm.
in. Maybe what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we gained anything, we gained the knowledge that helped us out in Desert Storm, because you had the generals and in Desert Storm were majors and captains in the field in the Army during Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and they, the smart ones that stayed in, decided that they weren't going to have to make the same mistake again.
Mm-hmm.
And so you noticed that Desert Storm was pretty well run by the military,
mm-hmm.
and I think they said what they were going to do, or told President Bush that you're going to let us do it our way,
mm-hmm.
and he said go right ahead,
mm-hmm.
and so you see what happened, and so I think if anything was gained off of it, out of the Vietnam experience, it was that. They weren't going to let that type of situation happen again. But then you turn right around, and our current administration has got us in Kosovo and other places,
mm-hmm.
which is a shame.
Well, what do you think about those types of forced deployments?
Well, they're babysitting jobs and meals on wheels, and that's not what the military was. The military was made to kill people and break things, period.
Mm-hmm.
And... You can't be a cop, and that's what these guys are, is, you know, cops keeping the peace, and that's not what they were there for. And I think that it's starting to show a lot in the attitude and the retention rates,
mm-hmm.
and this type of thing. They're spreading people way, way too thin,
mm-hmm.
with less and less money all the time. And when you gotta ration your fuel to fly airplanes for training and this type of thing, and supposedly the best military in the world, and you got to watch what you're spending here, spending there.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the way to be. Mm-hmm. We won the Cold War, but I think in the meantime, what happened there? We didn't have all of a sudden we didn't have an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have an enemy, you don't have the a focus.
Mm-hmm.
And the military lost its focus, and get involved with the UN and the peacekeeping thing. A certain amount of that's okay, but this the Kosovo thing is going on over there now, and Yugoslavia
mm-hmm.
is to me is it's going to end up bad here if we don't pull out of there in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Or hopefully tomorrow they should get out of there, but I know they're not going to do it.
Do you think that this is a problem for just the current administration or for our politicians generally now?
If it doesn't change in the next administration, it's going to be a problem for a long time, because you've got military. They've tried to make the military into the civilian world. And that's the big mistake. There was a guy, an active duty sergeant major, that was talking here a couple weeks ago, and he said you don't believe. He said you can walk into a barracks, an army barracks, and they cannot even tell the troops to walk into a troop's room and tell him to turn his radio down. Or you can get in trouble. And the reason is because if they happens to be somebody that wants to press the matter, and if let's say they get called up on it,
mm-hmm.
and the guy said, well, it's the way he asked the question or the way he told me, you know, it may have been a racial thing, and so they just don't even mess with it.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to fight it, so they just let them do what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the it's the nuts running the asylum is what it ends up being.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it's really pathetic. This guy was talking. He said, I've been in 25 years, and he said, I'm out of here. He said, I cannot discipline a troop without me getting in trouble for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to change. If that doesn't change, then it's then the military is gone for a few generations. And until, unfortunately, there is a conflict somewhere where you they have to learn how to be soldiers again. Because
mm-hmm.
right now they're not soldiers. They're, like I say, cops, babysitters, and Meals on Wheels.
Mm-hmm.
Personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. When do you think we should deploy American forces?
When there's a threat against us, and not a made-up threat. I think the Lyndon Johnson's little thing off the coast 64 was, I think that was, a lot of that was made up. A lot of it was. I'm sure. I know the attack came, and there was an attack, but it was all that was an excuse to pull the trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't that one, it had been something else. It had been another incident.
And here you're talking about the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Yeah, the Tonkin incident.
Yeah.
And the attack did happen. They did attack it, but it was that was the handy trigger
mm-hmm.
right there to start the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. The world's getting awfully small. We cannot be. Although they say we are, we can't be the policeman to the whole world. Because we don't have the facilities and the people
mm-hmm.
and the money to do it,
mm-hmm.
And if we spread it, trying to do it on the kind of budget that they've given the military, it's torn the whole thing up,
mm-hmm.
and let Europeans take care of Europeans, the English and the French and the Germans, let us lead this whole thing over there,
mm-hmm.
but to me, they're the ones that should have done it, and if we, and they say we'll call you if we need you,
mm-hmm.
but now they let us to be the first boys inside the ring,
mm-hmm.
which was stupid. Deploy an army when something needs to be, when you need to break things,
mm-hmm.
and teach somebody a lesson, but you do it quick and you get out, just like they did in. In Desert Storm,
mm-hmm.
You do it and say, "Here we are. We're done. We're out of here now." And don't waste time.
Mm-hmm. Have you been to the wall?
I've been to the one of the traveling walls.
Okay.
Have not been to the going next year. We've got TLCB reunion is in Fort Walton Beach next September. And then the September after that is back to D.C. at the wall. So
mm-hmm.
I'll be going in year after next.
Okay. What did you think of the moving wall that you saw?
Nice. Very nice. I've seen two of them.
Mm-hmm.
One about 10 or 12 years ago and one here about a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Very very moving, very well put on.
Mm-hmm.
They always find a nice park to put this thing in,
mm-hmm.
wherever they have it. And it was meaningful. I have about... I think half a dozen to a dozen guys on there that I knew, pilots mainly,
mm-hmm.
and one friend of my younger brother's that I knew, an Army who was killed over there, and it's the only nobody that in my generation except for the the guy that I went to college with,
mm-hmm.
That was killed as advisor in '63 or '64, but no close friends of mine were killed over there.
Mm-hmm.
But pilots, and a couple of them were close friends. that, in fact, one of them was my boss, that they just found his bones about 8 years ago.
Mm.
He was a B-52 navigator over Hanoi on Christmas of 72, and his B-52 was shot down.
Wow.
And they just found him about 8 or 9 years ago and buried him about 90 miles north of me. I went up to the funeral.
Okay.
Early for that, and that was pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
But then a couple of guys that I used to brief and debrief there at the 8th Attack Fighter Wing, we lost probably half a dozen pilots to ground fire, and probably another six. I knew six of the guys that were in Hanoi Hilton.
Mm-hmm.
That were from Ubon Base and spent time as POWs.
Mm-hmm.
One of them wouldn't have bothered me if they'd have kept him.
Do you want to elaborate on that? Or?
No, because he goes around the country now giving speeches. And he's he was just kind of an arrogant guy.
Oh.
You know, he's big Swede or big Norwegian that always bragged about how many he was gonna planes he was gonna shoot down, which was unusual in the Air Force type pilot,
because
most of them did not have that kind of a braggadocio.
Hmm.
But not
even fighter pilots.
Huh?
Not even the fighter pilots.
Well, yeah, you know, among yourself, you know, they bragged each other to club,
mm-hmm.
but they don't walk into a room saying, you know, I'm going, here's where I'm going today, I'm going to have a they had a gun emplacement right across the border in the North Vietnam at a place called Dong Hoi Ferry. And there was a gunner there shooting, I think, 57 millimeter. I can't remember what kind of, but they called his nickname was the Mad Gunner of Dong Hoi Ferry among all the pilots. But you didn't get around him. Because, I mean, he was deadly accurate.
Mm-hmm.
See, so they avoided this guy. And I guess Laird had, Major Gunnarsson, he'd been hosed down with this guy once before.
Mm-hmm.
And about 2 weeks later, well, the targets came up, and one of them was an area around that ferry. And he said, when I get done here, he said, I'm going to go down, I'm going to have a pissing contest with that son of a bitch. And he said, I'm going to get him. Well, he ended up in a parachute coming down over the North China Sea.
Oops.
Because the Mad Gunner got him. So they picked him up and brought him back. And then he got in, they stayed over there, didn't get injured or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave him another plane, and about 2 months later, he was up over Hanoi. And lackadaisical attitude, you know, and the forward air control, not the forward air controllers, but the radar ships up above could tell them when a MiG was in attack mode, or if it was going away, coming toward them, if it was arming itself, and you know, they had all these everything they could tell the pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept telling him that, you know, this guy was coming at him, and he don't worry about it, I'll get him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like about that time he got a missile up his ass.
Oh.
So he spent the next 4 and 5 or 6 years in the Hanoi Hilton, but he goes around now giving motivational speeches, that type of stuff. But
mm-hmm.
He was a little bit arrogant. Very unusual for, and they're cocky, but you know, they have to be confident and cocky, these guys that you know, flew every day, like some, they, you know, most of them flew up there every day just like they were going to the office.
Mm.
You know, fly up there and get shot at every day and then come home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, next day get up and do it again. I don't know if I'd do it the first time.
Yeah.
You got a lot more guts than I had.
Mm-hmm.
I've got shot at, you know, once or twice up there, but really, I really, really didn't get quote unquote shot at. Those guys got shot at.
Mm-hmm.
There were people that were trying to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Every day.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, they'd jump on those F-4s and away they go. Mm-hmm. They, number one, they loved to fly. And, you know, number two, they had a mission. And number three, they were, you know, they were doing what they were trained to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, God bless every one of them. They were great.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stood in awe of them every day I was over there. Well, they could do that, but super bunch of guys.
Do you think we could have done anything different or better in Vietnam?
Oh, if they would have, yeah, if they'd have taken the rules of engagement off, which I think everybody at Juul that had anything to do with that portion of it would say, you know, whether it be Army, Air Force, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The rules of engagement over there were so restrictive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was put on us by, you know, the civilians that, you know, where they got the stuff, I don't have any idea. But, you know, 90% of it was ridiculous. And if they would have let us early enough, now back in 68, 69, 70, when I was there,
mm-hmm.
Maybe not. But if they would have turned them loose in 64, 65, the North Vietnamese weren't ready. I think if they'd gone in with a full-blown ground invasion, the war would have been over in 6 to 8 months.
Hmm.
We'd have had maybe, I don't know, 70,000, 80,000 casualties, but it would have been over with.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd given it back to them and come home again, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Just like we do every time. But later on, it wouldn't have been, I don't think it would have been possible. They were too much. Now, the Christmas bombing of 72, when we did that,
mm-hmm.
when Nixon ordered that,
mm-hmm.
and that was, that could have broken their backs if we would have ignored them, because all of a sudden, do you remember the history right, that when we put all those B-52s over Hanoi and we started laying, you know, actually pulverizing that city into little bits, it didn't take them very long to all of a sudden they were back at the peace table.
Mm-hmm.
And if we would have ignored them and just kept bombing,
mm-hmm.
I do think there would have been a capitulation there.
Because mm-hmm.
they were terrified. They didn't think that we would do that. And we did it.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we, as soon as they went back to the peace table, why, boom, they cut it off.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they wanted us to do, and I think that's what they knew we would do. But if we would have said no, we're not going to stop bombing until A, B, C, D, E, F, G is
mm-hmm.
done,
mm-hmm.
and then I think it would have been a little different story.
Mm. What are the major lessons you think we should take away from the Vietnam War as a nation? It kind of touches on some of the things you already said,
yeah.
But
yeah, kind of said most of the stuff I think, but.
Well, let me ask you this. What did you take away from the experience yourself personally that helped you as a person?
That took away personally?
Mm-hmm.
I think it made me, I know that it made me a lot more aware of what my government does from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
It made me a lot more tolerant of other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
The I really fell in love with the Thai people themselves,
mm-hmm.
and enjoyed and still I go to Thai restaurants as often as I can,
mm-hmm.
around here, because I, you know, I like the food and like the people.
Mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot about culture. I learned a lot about tolerance. I have a rough time when I hear somebody that makes an ignorant statement about especially other countries,
mm-hmm.
That either hasn't been there or hasn't taken the time to learn anything about it. They just, you know, the old stereotype crap.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's helped me out. I was pretty tolerant to begin with. I wasn't racial.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in an all white little southern Kansas farm town.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never saw a black till I went to college. But I made black friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and didn't have any pre-existing ideas of how I should act or they should act.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's made me a lot wiser. I know I've taught my children a lot of the things that I learned over there, and I've gone to to some of the high schools around here and given talks on Vietnam when they spend enough time on it.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them in history classes, as you may well know, my 16-year-old daughter was taking world her American history last year, and she
mm-hmm.
spent a total of 30 minutes
mm-hmm.
on the Vietnam War.
Because mm-hmm.
I kept telling her, I said, whenever you get ready to do that, I said, if the teacher wants, I'll come and give a little, you know, a little speech on it.
Mm-hmm.
And okay, well, never happened
mm-hmm.
because they didn't spend enough time on it.
That's no surprise.
Yeah. And like there was like, you know, 10 pages and the 5 pages in the book about it.
Mm-hmm.
It really did talk about it, talk more about the political situation than it did the war itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Democratic Convention, the protests, and,
right.
you know, San Francisco hippies and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That it didn't deal with the actual military side of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty typical anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That most kids don't learn a lot of history anymore. And when I went to high school, we learned everything. So I'm like, my kids always, you know, the trivia thing and who wants to be a millionaire?
Mm-hmm.
And I can sit there and, you know, pop off the answers for those things. I said, where'd you learn that? I said, I learned it in the school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was, 10 years old or
mm-hmm.
12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I said, didn't everybody? And we'd never heard of this before, you know. And that just shows me that, you know, they don't teach the stuff.
No.
They're too busy teaching them how to be, how to interact with each other in a social situation than they are the 3 R's or history or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I took away from it probably a lot more than I really realized. I took away from it. It made me a lot more a lot more calmer individual than when I came back than when I left. More tolerant of other people's opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm pretty opinionated, but. I was willing to sit down and listen to people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is there anything else you'd like to discuss this evening? Or?
No, I'm about run out here, I think.
Okay.
I'm wound down.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much. Let me go ahead and stop this recording real quick.
Okay.
This ends the interview with Mr. Larry Klum.